members, today we've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 bills, and it is our intent to get through those bills today. We're going to start off with the with my bill, which is the Department Education, the policy bill from the department. Before we do that, I'll need a motion to approve our minutes from March 8th.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Benson moves approval of the minutes from March 8th. All in favor of that motion, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same signs. Motion prevails. So members, I do apologize for starting late. It's that time of year in the session, and so we have committees that'll tend to run a little bit over, but hopefully we'll finish at a decent time this morning. Thank you all for your patience. I'm going to ask Representative Dietrich to assume the gavel while I go forward and present our bill.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. The next bill that we have before us is House File 1197. Representative Mariani, Mr. Chairman, would you like to move your bill, please?
Madam Chair, I would. I would move that House File, House File 1197 be recommended to pass and referred to the Finance Committee, and our recommendation would be that it be re-referred to the K-12 Finance Committee.
Thank you. Would you like to walk through the bill?
Madam Chair, I would, and I want to apologize ahead of time. We heard late last night, and I'm a little tired today, so hopefully the verbal exchanges won't overtax me today. Madam Chair and members, this comes to us as the Department policy bill, so I'm going to ask the department to do a walkthrough of the bill. I believe it got a couple folks that they want to offer some brief testimony to elements in the bill. I do have a couple amendments that I want us to get to after that. So, Madam Chair, I'll turn it over to the department at this point.
Commissioner Anderson, you plan to start?
Madam Chair, Tom Meltzer, Dr. Meltzer will begin.
Okay.
Article 1.
Okay, Dr. Meltzer, proceed.
Madam Chair and members, my name is Tom Meltzer. I'm the Finance Director at the Department of Education. I'll be walking through Article 1. This includes some technical changes as well as some policy changes. Section 1 of the bill is simply correcting a cross-reference relating to the property tax shift. That's purely a technical correction. Section 2 of the bill on page 2 is deleting obsolete language. You see the stricken language there is obsolete language from fiscal 2006. And the other change on page 3, line 11, would be including the referendum tax-based replacement aid in the definition of general education aid. And what that does is eliminates the need to have a separate appropriation for tax-based replacement aid as opposed to the rest of general education aid. This tax-based replacement aid pays a part of the state share of the referendum levy that school districts make. And this amendment does not have any fiscal impact. It's simply eliminating the need to have a separate appropriation for the tax-based replacement aid as opposed to the remainder of general education aid. It simplifies the calculations a little bit, has no net impact on any districts. Section 3 of the bill is a clarification of which school district pays the penalty if a cooperative does not maintain effort for special education. We have a provision in law that calls for a reduction of general education aid if a school district does not maintain effort for special education. However, the current law is not clear what happens if a cooperative does not maintain effort. Our intent in implementing this would be that if a particular school district member of a cooperative caused the cooperative to not maintain effort, then the penalty would be directed toward that district and not toward other districts that were, in fact, maintaining their effort. This makes that clarification in law. We have not actually had any school districts or cooperatives fail to maintain effort, but in the event that that should ever happen, we just wanted the law to be clear as to how the penalty would be assessed. Section 4 is another technical cross-reference correction relating to the property tax shift. Section 5 is a technical update relating to the abatement levy. A number of years ago, we added the referendum market value as a basis for spreading some of our tax levies, and the cross-references in the abatement statute were never updated. They need to be updated, and this is reflecting that, and again, does not change any calculations, just simply is reflecting our current practice in administering that statute. And Section 6 and 7 of Article 1 are also technical corrections. They are repealing an obsolete provision from the 1970s dealing with students that were attending non-resident districts before we had our open enrollment system that we have currently. All of the students that were affected by this provision have graduated from high school, and it does not affect any students, so we need to just clean up the statutes by repealing that section and providing a revisor's instruction to make corrections associated with that.
If you don't mind, Commissioner Anderson, are there any questions for Dr. Melcher? Any questions from members? Okay.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Chaz Anderson. I'm the Deputy Education Commissioner. Starting on to Article 2, which is on page 5, Section 1, Subdivision 7 clarifies educational records, meaning that educational records would have to be transferred to schools, and it would add charter schools and non-public schools to this requirement. This is consistent with federal law. So if a student transfers, for example, from a non-public school to a public school, that non-public would need to transfer those educational records to the public school and vice versa, and the same thing with charter schools, so that we have consistency when students enroll across non-public schools, charter schools, and public schools. If you look at number B, this clarifies what happens when a charter school closes. In recent years, we've had a few of those close. There's been questions of where do those educational records go to for those students immediately upon closure of the charter school and before the student decides to enroll in a different school. And what we're clarifying that to be is that the closed charter school must transfer those student educational records within 10 business days to the resident district of that student. If you look at paragraph C, that's just clarifying language that any of the educational record must include any formal suspension, expulsion, and exclusionary disciplinary action. The previous language was a bit vague in what needed to be transferred. And then also adding the requirement, which is consistent with federal law under FERPA, that any transfer of this data needs to requires parental or guardian notification. Going on to
Commissioner Anderson, may I interrupt you just for a second? Representative Tilbury has a question, and I think it's appropriate to address it right now.
Thank you, Chair. I have a question regarding the non-public school, where you said that they would supply records. Does that have a kind of like cause them to send records in case the student had not made payment to that school? What happens in our experiences is that a private school can withhold records to the public school as long if they have not made a payment or they still owe money to that private school. Does this address any of that or not?
Madam Chair, Representative, that does not address that. Actually, this would require that school to transfer those records to the public school. And this is actually consistent with federal law as well.
Representative Tilbury, did you have another question?
Can you follow that again? I didn't follow what you just said.
Madam Chair, Representative, could you repeat the question, please?
Yeah. A private school, a kid that comes from a private school and transfers to a public school, the private school withholds the transcript or records because they did not receive the final payments from the family. Does this address that?
Madam Chair, Representative, if this were to become law, the Menon Public School would have to transfer those records to the public school.
Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. Proceed.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, going to Section 2, which is the Gifted and Talented Students Programming, just an update to the legislature. In 2005, the legislature established a separate categorical aid program for gifted and talented, providing $4 a student in fiscal year 08 and $9 per student in fiscal year 07. This just clarifies that, along with most categorical aid programs, there needs to be policies or procedures in place for the program, and this would establish policies and procedures that school districts would adopt for academic acceleration of gifted and talented students. And that includes assessing a student's readiness and motivation for acceleration and match the level of complexity and pace of curriculum for the student to achieve the best type of acceleration.
Okay. Commissioner Anderson, we have somebody who would like to speak to that section. So I would like to call on that person right now, Dana Coulter from the Minnesota Council on the Gifted and Talented. Welcome to the committee, and please state your name and position for the record.
My name is Dana Coulter, and I am a parent, and I'm also a member of the Minnesota Council for Gifted and Talented, and I am here today along with two other of my members, and I would like to address the committee on the topic of acceleration policies. And I would also like to tell you about a little bit about our group. We are a group of parents and other professionals that have a mission of promoting better understanding of and educational services for gifted and talented children and their families. Imagine being a child who enters school reading at a fifth grade level and doing math at a third grade level. What does the kindergarten curriculum have to offer this child? How well can this child interact with other kindergartners whom he is well beyond? What do the parents and school districts do with this type of a child? One option is acceleration. The child that I'm describing is my child. We knew he needed to be accelerated. The school does not do this automatically. It took much effort, data gathering, outside testing, meetings, money, and convincing for my child to be placed at an appropriate level of learning. It really should not be this hard. According to A Nation Deceived, How America Holds Back Its Brightest Students, a 2004 national report on acceleration, acceleration is one of the most well-researched and effective strategies for meeting the needs of bright students, yet it is one of the least used. The report, I actually have a copy of right here, and it's actually accessible on the internet at www.nationdeceived.org. Acceleration is essentially matching the child with an appropriate level of curriculum where the child can learn new material and continue to progress in his learning. It can take several forms: early admission to kindergarten or first grade skipping, subject matter acceleration, curriculum compacting, telescoping curriculum, distance learning, and so forth. Acceleration is not for everyone, but is the answer for some. If the state does not require districts to have a policy on acceleration, the many myths and misunderstandings about acceleration will continue, and many children will stagnate in their learning, become disengaged from school, and fail to be served appropriately by our public schools. The state of Minnesota cannot afford to lose a valuable resource like our bright children. Please require school districts to have acceleration policies. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Coulter.
Thank you.
Commissioner Anderson, would you like to proceed?
Yes, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Moving to Section 3, this section of the bill is related to the statewide testing and reporting system. The department is proposing some minor cleanup changes to the language and also to reflect the language on the grad test, which is the new state graduation requirement that was adopted in 2005. The first change that is made is on page 7. If you look at lines 7.7 to 7.8, this is just cleanup language. Instead of the state basic skills, saying basic skills. Numbers 1 is being stricken. That's related to the BST, which has now been retired, effective with the enactment of the 2005 legislation. 7.10 just renumbers the language. And then if you go in to base 7.12 to 7.10, 15. This discusses how the grad test will be administered. For members of the committee, just a review of that. What will happen is with the high school MCA2 assessments in grade 10 for reading or language arts, grade 11 for math, a subset of questions will be embedded into that test that will be representative of the grad test. And the idea was, when this was adopted, was to eliminate an administration of a test in grade 8 and move that to the high school and embed it within one test. So it was, in effect, eliminating two state tests and using the high school test for two separate purposes. So this clarifies that the grad test would be for those grades and the subset of questions. Also, grade 9 would include a writing test, which was similar to what the basic skills test also provided. The way that a student in this language could meet the graduation requirement would two different ways. One would be to answer a certain percentage of questions correctly on the subset of grad test questions, and the student does not know which test questions would be counted for MCA or the grad test. Or they could meet proficiency on the MCA2 assessment. It is that language then is reflected if you look at 7.17 through 7.36 at the bottom of the page, and then throughout that, if you go to page 8, it specifies the same thing for writing. As you may know, we are also proposing to establish rules for proper administration of this test. The rules generally, and it's actually going to be included in an amendment that will be looked at the end of this walkthrough, that includes provisions for students that transfer, PSEO students, special ed students, ELL students. And on that piece, the amendment specifies what rulemaking authority we're requesting on that piece. So if you want, we could take up that piece now, or we could wait till the full amendment is offered at the end of the bill.
Commissioner Anderson, I think we'll wait for the full amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Line 8.14 is just cleanup language, changing spelling out third to using third as the number. It's renumbering then the rest of that. If you look at 8.18, 8.22, if you look at language on lines 8.26 and 8.27, this is just providing a language that accommodations or alternative assessments need to be consistent with federal law, but also need to be technically sound accommodations and assessments. We've added language on 8.29 and 8.30 that discusses whether or not a general statewide test is inappropriate for student rather than incapable, because those are two different meanings. And then if you look at 8.31 to 8.32, we strike language on if the student has been in the United States for fewer than 3 years. Really, that has to be the appropriateness of what test is taken is decided at the local district level. It shouldn't be decided on the number of years a student has entered into this country. 8.36 is really just cleanup language. We never actually release student scores on the ACT. It should say state results on the ACT. You go to page 9. We are eliminating 9.5 to 9.6, which requires districts to report exemptions of students not taking the MCA2s. We actually already collect this through the testing process, so to have a district report it to us again is just duplicative. We know in the testing process who has been exempted from taking the MCA2 test, so there's no need for a second requirement for districts to report the data. Later on page 9.24, the word value added is stricken to basically, and that will be actually another amendment that we'll talk about further, so I'll just delay that discussion here. 9.31 just talks about, again, technically sound accommodations for students. And then going to page 10, we are requesting language change on 10.11. This talks reporting on three performance baselines. We call those performance achievement levels, and actually there's four different achievement levels in currently. 10.12, we actually use unweighted test scores. We don't use the mean of test scores when we look at students as they score on the test. And then on 10.22, instead of a copy of the student's actual answer sheet, we actually want to show the responses. Madam Chair, that would conclude Section 3.
Okay. Are you going to continue with Section 4, or is
Madam Chair, I actually want to call up Dan Bittman from our licensing director to go over Section 4.
Okay, welcome to the committee, Mr. Bittman. Please state your name and position for the record and proceed.
Madam Chair, Representative, my name is Daniel Bittman. I'm the Director of Educator Licensing at the Department of Education. In regard to Section 4 regarding highly qualified, this is just a cleanup of language so that we are consistent with federal law. Previously, it had stated that it did not place a limit on who could use the house. The federal government has clarified who is able to use the house for a means of demonstrating competency. Demonstrating competency to meet highly qualified is extremely different than licensing in itself. For example, a special education teacher is licensed to teach that specific disability, does not speak to the core content as it relates to No Child Left Behind. The language that was stricken and the language that was added then makes it consistent with federal law in accordance with No Child Left Behind.
Madam Chair, moving to the next change on page 12.
Commissioner Anderson, would you please identify yourself for the record?
Yes, my name is Chaz Anderson, Deputy Education Commissioner. Madam Chair, members of the committee, moving to the next change on page 12, line 12.33, we're striking language that requires school districts to submit a report to the department requiring that they calculate to the state of Minnesota what it would cost for a student to achieve 100% proficiency on the basic skills test. We no longer administer this test anymore. We actually have very small compliance of school districts actually filling out this report. It's a request of a couple of educational organizations, including MASBO, which is the Business Officers Association, to repeal this reporting requirement for school districts. Madam Chair, moving to Section 6, this is relates to the online learning law. If you look at page line 13.14, we're clarifying that the 30 days, the student must notify the enrolling district of an online learning course that it be 30 calendar days. There was some misunderstanding whether that was calendar or working days, so we're clarifying that it's calendar days. And then we're adding additional language on 13.21 to 13.22, clarifying that student applications may not be rejected for criteria listed in essentially the state's open enrollment law, which is Minnesota Statute 124D.03, and Subdivision 6 refers to the basis for decisions for open enrollment. Madam Chair, moving to Section 7, we're striking language that requires that the commissioner, that a charter school sponsor, a charter school board that has been rejected by a sponsor may go to the commissioner for the department to sponsor that charter school or for the department to assist in finding a new sponsor. In 2005, the legislature repealed the authority for the commissioner to sponsor additional new charter schools, and so that's inconsistent with that law because we technically cannot sponsor any new charter schools. And then the second provision, we feel it's not really the department's job to find sponsors for charter schools. The charter school board should be seeking out sponsors and finding those instead of the department finding them sponsors.
So that brings us to Section 8.
Madam Chair, Section 8, this is related to the charter school lease costs. As some of the members may know here, a few years ago, we included a conflict of interest provision on the lease aid, which is very consistent with federal law, conflict of interest for federal startup aid under the charter school law. What we are proposing to do is to take the conflict of interest that's spelled out in the charter school lease aid law and apply it to the entire charter school law. It doesn't make sense to have conflict of interest provisions in one revenue stream and not the entire charter school law, and it makes for, could be inconsistent application of laws within that statute. Okay. Madam Chair, going to page 16, Section 9, I've already talked about this a little bit, but this is again another cross-reference to what happens when a charter school closes, that those student records must be returned to the resident district upon closure of that charter school.
Dr. Melcher, I see you at the table. Are you going to proceed with Section 10?
Madam Chair and members, yes. My name
Pretty
is Tom
smart,
Melcher,
aren't I?
Department of Education. Article 2, Section 10 is clarifying the version of average daily membership that we will be using in the new secondary vocational, or I should say career and technical, education levy. There was legislation enacted a couple of years ago that has changed the formula. We'll now be using current year information, where for the past several years we've used a frozen count from 2001. However, the legislation as enacted did not specify which calculation of average daily membership we use. We do have several, including the resident average daily membership, the adjusted average daily membership, and the served average daily membership. And it was our belief that the served average daily membership would come the closest to measuring the need for the career and technical services, reflecting the actual students being served in the high school. And so we're suggesting that a clarification be made there to use the served average daily membership. And Section 11 is just a technical correction of a cross-reference error.
And Section 12, are you going to?
Yes. Madam Chair, Chairman, the Education Commissioner. Section 12 makes clarification changes to the American Indian Scholarship Program. This is a state-funded program providing higher education scholarships to American Indian students. And a recent legislative audit report made recommendations for the department's administration of this program, including that the distribution of scholarships be based upon post-secondary institution recommendations and also be awarded after the application of federal Pell money, state grant money, and other scholarships, and be dependent on the student's unmet needs after those monies have been awarded. Currently, the only policy we had on board on this was something adopted by the State Board of Education in 1994. Which was sort of vague about how the scholarships would be awarded. And so this would require us to work with post-secondary institutions and Office of Higher Education in awarding these scholarships after the application of federal and state dollars have been applied. Also, this clarifies existing practice that American Indian student would qualify for 5 years of studies at an undergraduate level and 5 years at a graduate level. The student also may acquire only one degree per level and one terminal degree, and a terminal degree is typically such as a PhD or a doctorate degree. There is a small technical amendment to this language. I think it's included in the author's amendment. It's just a typo that was on 18.17 that will be included. If some folks see that, doesn't read quite right.
Okay. Commissioner Anderson, we have a question or a comment from Representative Ward, if we can interrupt you for a moment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a question, Commissioner Anderson. I'm going back a bit on the closing of the charter school in the Section 9, Subdivision 24, where it talked about the closing of the charter school must transfer students' education records. I thought I had remembered earlier that it had given the charter school 10 school days. Why doesn't it do that in the second subdivision?
Madam Chair, Representative, we could certainly make that change. I was wondering if the statute listed just cross-references what we're going to change, or I don't know if Ms. Larson could help with that. But
Ms. Larson.
Madam Chair, members, it could be done either way. We could insert within the 10 business days of closure, or we could insert the statute.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
I just wanted it to be clear that so there was no misinterpretation by anybody.
Okay. Would you like to present an oral amendment?
Whatever Ms. Larson thinks is appropriate, that would be fine with me, Madam Chair. As I'm having a little bit of a problem with this mic also. So.
Ms. Larson, what do you have written up here for us?
Madam Chair, members, on House File 1197, Article 2, Section 9, page 16, line 17, after the word records, insert comma, within 10 business days of closure, comma.
Okay. Representative Erickson was commenting about the word calendar. Do we need that in there?
Madam Chair, Representative Erickson, business days is what appears in Section 1 of Article 2, and so I'm using exactly the same phrase.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
Oh.
I also noticed that on page 16.18, it says Section 122A, and on page 5, it's 120A. Ms. Larson.
Madam Chair, members, that's another correction that's in the author amendment.
Well, thank you, Representative Lane. I'm impressed. Representative Ward, is that amendment satisfactory? Okay. Yeah, I will move the amendment. I was going to see a representative. I will move the amendment on page 16, line 17, after the word records, to insert comma within 10 business days. All those in favor? Oh, of closure. Comma. All those in favor of that oral amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Amendment is adopted. Okay. Commissioner Anderson.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Section 13 is the revisor's instructions, and Section 14 is the repealer that I'll have Dan Bittman discuss for you.
Okay, Mr. Bittman, please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Daniel Bittman. I'm the Director of Educator Licensing at the Department of Education. The repealer relates to a former commissioner exemption that allowed the commissioner to grant permission for a non-licensed individual to teach English as a second language or bilingual education in cases of hardship. There was somewhat of a duplicate. There are other procedures in place with the Board of Teaching that already allow that. Within the last 2 years, as of February 12th, there were only 7 individuals that took advantage of it, and actually they could have used a limited permit or limited license, excuse me, or a community expert license in those situations. And so really the commissioner's exemption is not needed, and it does not comply with No Child Left Behind.
Are you done?
I am. Thank you.
Okay. Commissioner Anderson, are you going to proceed?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Dr. Melcher will go through Article 3 of the bill.
Welcome back, Dr. Melcher.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Tom Melcher with the Department of Education. Section 1 of Article 3 does two things. There are several places on page 19 and 20 where we have added the word equalization to clarify the calculation of general education revenue that is used in doing the tuition billing calculations. That portion is a technical clarification. Page 20, line 11 and 12 also has a substantive change that is adding sites approved under Section 125A 515 to the list of programs that can receive a waiver from the tuition billing process. These are residential programs licensed by the Department of Human Services and the Department of Corrections. They operate quite expensive programs due to the nature of the students that they serve, and we received some very good information from the St. Cloud School District as well as some other school districts that have relatively high-cost programs here. The existing tuition billing system will not fully cover their costs, and we wanted to make available to them the opportunity to have a waiver from this system, similar to what we do with intermediate school districts and cooperatives. Section 2 of Article 3 is changing language from summer programs to extended school year to conform with federal language in the IDEA Part B. So this would conform the state language to the federal language and clarify that the funding for what we used to call summer programs is now called extended school year programs in the federal law, and that aligns our mechanism with the federal language. Section 3 of the bill is including community-based services in the travel that is covered under the special education home-based travel statute. The current statute refers only to home base, but for the past 20 years or so, we have been including community-based programs in this as well. That would include students that are being served at hospitals or Head Start programs or early childhood education programs, other programs in community-based areas. So we are providing a clarification that those are allowable travel expenses as well as to the actual student's home. Section 4 is deleting redundant language dealing with regular school year and summer programs. Again, we're trying to eliminate the references to summer school and conform to federal law by using the extended services language. Section 5 of the bill is dealing with the calculation of special education base revenue. What we have found is that as the definition of general education revenue has changed over the years, the cross references to general education revenue in the special education statute have not been updated regularly, and this will conform the calculation or the use of general education revenue to the current definitions. It will also clarify that alternative teacher compensation revenue is excluded from the calculation of the contracted services revenue. We've done this in other areas as well where the idea was not to penalize districts that have received the alternative teacher compensation revenue by reducing their special education aid. Section 6 of the bill is doing a similar updating of the language as it relates to the out-of-state tuition for special education students. Section 7 is technical corrections of the language in special education tuition billing, again, clarifying that the referendum aid that we're using is the referendum equalization aid.
Madam Chair.
Commissioner Anderson.
Section 8 of the bill relates to the department's maltreatment of minors program. The department's responsible for investigating complaints of maltreatment within schools. Right now, under current law, when that investigation is undergoing, the data is considered private information under the investigation. The only recipients that could receive information would be the suspect or the person being investigated could receive the information of the investigation, or the parent of the parent could receive information about his or her child. What we're proposing to do here is actually consistent with what Department of Human Services and the Department of Health have in their statutes, which is during the investigation that information would be made confidential, and that would prohibit the subject of the investigation from receiving information as the or data as the investigation is undertaking. What happens in many cases is that, particularly where a criminal, where there's a suspect of suspicion of criminal activity, the department and law enforcement will jointly conduct investigations, mostly with law enforcement taking the lead. And the reason for that is not to have two separate investigations going on, not to jeopardize one or the other, and also it is not best practice to interview victims, that particularly that include children, more than once. So we'd like to interview those victims and witnesses at one time rather than under two separate investigations. What is happening is law enforcement's investigation is confidential, the department's is private, and the subject of the investigation is actually able to obtain everything under our investigation, which is similar, which is basically going hand in hand with law enforcement's investigation, and it's potentially down the road and has in a few instances it's caused problems as we've conducted these investigations with law enforcement. And so, as consistent with what the Department of Human Services has as authority and the Department of Health, we would like that information confidential as the investigation is going on. And then once that investigation is complete, the data becomes private, and that individual would be able to obtain all that information as part of the suspect in the investigation. Madam Chair, moving to Section 9, that is repealers, which Dr. Melcher will review.
Dr. Melcher.
Madam Chair, Tom Melcher with the Department of Education. This would repeal Section 125A 10, dealing with interagency services for students with disabilities, and it would repeal 125A75 subdivision 6, which is a requirement for a separate application for special education summer school aid, which are obsolete.
Okay.
Article 4 of the bill, section 1, would add a 10-year limit onto the capital project referendum levy. That's on page 28, line 23. Currently, school districts can go to the voters and request approval to do a capital project referendum. Currently, those are not limited to a certain number of years. However, the operating referendum levy for school districts are limited to a 10-year period. We currently do not have any school districts that have in place a capital project referendum levy that lasts for longer than 10 years. We feel like 10 years is a pretty good distance for school districts to be looking out, and it would be very difficult for districts to project their facilities needs much beyond the 10-year period. And so we thought that since there are no districts currently that would be affected by that, that it would be appropriate to allow the voters to look at these capital project referendum levies once every 10 years the way that they do with operating referendum levies. And so that would add a new requirement in law.
Dr. Meltzer, Representative Ward has another question.
Dr. Meltzer, would this have any kind of a financial impact on school districts? I mean, right now, I know it's open. Putting the 10 years, restricting the 10 years, is that going to have any kind of a negative financial impact on districts? I know you said that, I know you said there's no districts that have currently more than 10 years. But if we put into law and we limit them to 10 years, could there be a negative impact?
Madam Chair and Representative Ward, there could be a potential where a school district would otherwise like to go out for a 20-year referendum or a 30-year referendum, and this would limit them to going to the voters once every 10 years, so they might need to have an election 10 years from now. For example, if they were going to the voters next year for a 20-year referendum, that they would now be limited to 10 years, so then 10 years from now they would have to go back to the voters, and there would be the cost of an additional election down the road 10 years from now when it came time to renew it.
Okay, on to Article 5.
Madam Chair and members, Article 5, Section 1 would eliminate obsolete reserve accounts. We have a number of accounts that have been set up in our UFARS financial accounting system over the years that no longer have any current money going into them, that are kind of residual. And they include the old bus purchase levy. There's the old bus purchase account, which was related to a bus purchase levy, which is no longer there. There's a parent involvement reserve, a student transportation safety reserve, a reserve for graduation standards staff development, reserve for graduation standards. These are all tied to dollar flows that existed in the past, which are no longer there, and some of these are 5 to 10 years old, and the money just kind of sitting in these accounts in some cases. And this is an effort to try to simplify, clean up the laws. I know that Representative Greiling, I believe, has a bill later that would deal with some of these same issues. This is taking the ones that are purely non-controversial, that no longer have any new money going in.
Dr. Meltzer, just for clarification, that is Representative Benson's bill, House File 234, which we are taking up later today. Thank you.
My apologies. Thank
That's
you.
All right.
Madam Chair.
Commissioner Anderson.
Article 6 simply clarifies actually existing practice. The department is responsible for supervision of the Minnesota Library for the Blind and Physically Handicapped under a cooperative agreement with the National Library Services for the Blind and Physically Handicapped. We've always been under the supervision, but there's no statute that actually provides for anyone to supervise that library. And as you know, that we also have statewide libraries under the jurisdiction of the State Department of Education. So this simply clarifies what is existing practice.
Madam Chair, Karen Carlson with the Department of Education. I'm going to do Article 7.
Ms. Carlson, just so members know, we're going to move on to early childhood education. Go ahead.
Madam Chair, on page 29, line 29 and point 28, and on 30.6 is, those are a couple of purely technical changes that were overlooked last year. And starting with lines 30.7, we current practice in the Head Start programs, we currently allocate funds based on a statutory formula, and payments are made to programs on their reported expenditures up to the total allocation, and that's regardless of the number of children served. So we're now changing the language to base the payments on the number of children actually served. And so that's what lines 30.7 to 30.16 do, and we've been working with the Head Start Association on this language, and we're all holding hands on the language together. So.
Thank you, Ms. Carlson.
It's an important thing, and it also is, it parallels the federal language, too, so we're all
wonderful.
Fits just fine. The next section is on, actually, Section 2 and Section 3. The two sections deal with an issue that recently has been getting some attention from the Head Start feds, and that is they're trying to promote more full-day services in Head Start because the children are needing full-day services, parents are working, whatever. And so we are intent in this language, and we are working with the Head Start Association. We're going to clean up this language a little bit just to clarify it even more clearly. But our intent is to boost our number of programs that either do provide full-day services themselves, which is defined as 6 hours by the federal government, or work in partnership with child care centers or child care homes to get that service to the Head Start children. So that's what those two sections do, and you'll probably see an amendment coming through the next round to just clarify that language.
I believe
a little bit
we will.
More.
Then Section 4.
Section 4 is Dr. Melcher's section.
Dr. Melcher, please.
Madam Chair and members, Tom Melcher with the Department of Education. Sections 4, 5, and 6 are an effort to clarify the authority of school districts to charge fees for full-day kindergarten. 2 years ago, the department issued a memorandum on this issue. The law is not totally clear as to whether school districts can or cannot charge fees for full-day kindergarten. There are many school districts in the state that currently are charging fees for full-day kindergarten. The memorandum that we sent out at the time, after review with the Attorney General's office, essentially said that a school district cannot charge fees for full-day kindergarten. However, they can charge fees for a half-time school-age care program, which is run in conjunction with a full-day kindergarten program. And it's resulted in a lot of sort of gymnastics on the part of school districts in terms of wanting to provide a full-day kindergarten program and letting parents know this is a full-day kindergarten program, but then for reporting to the department, they're calling it a school-age care program. So it creates a lot of confusion out there as to what kind of a program this really is. And so the proposal here would be to clarify exactly when you can and can't charge a fee. What Section 4 does would be to define full-day kindergarten as an academic program that prepares students to enter first grade, is provided for a minimum of 850 hours in a school year. That's 5 hours a day for 170 days a year, and would include curriculum and instruction that aligns with academic standards. It also would say that learning activities provided through community education are not full-day kindergarten. So following up on that definition, then, the fee law would be amended in Section 5 to specify that a school district could charge fees for the unreimbursed portion of a pre-kindergarten program or for the additional cost of an optional full-day kindergarten program in a district that also provides a half-time kindergarten program option to its students, except that there would be no fee charged for providing a child with a disability a free and appropriate public education, and that a district doing these fees would be required to establish a reasonable sliding fee schedule so that that students that have low income could participate in the program. And Section 6 is related to that.
But I would just like to stop you at this point and just remind members that this bill will be is going to be referred to K-12 Finance, and there it will be compared to other all-day, everyday kindergarten programs and bills. So by no means having this language in this bill means that we are adopting a program. Proceed, Dr. Melcher.
Madam Chair, Section 6 is clarifying also in another section of the fee law that these particular fees would be allowable.
Madam Chair, Section 7 is...
Yes, Ms. Carlson.
I believe the author is
okay.
And Section 8, we are proposing to repeal, and the author is reinstating this here.
More gymnastics, huh?
The repeal of Section 8, we were repealing the Minnesota Early Learning Foundation language, and members may recall that last session, the Early Learning Foundation was established in law as a public-private partnership, and during the summer, the Early Learning Foundation decided that it would not pursue the public partnership, that they would keep vested as a private board, and so we proposed to repeal the language. And in November, we started talking to the MELT, and they agreed to repeal, and we've had several conversations about it. So that's why it's proposing it.
On to Article 8.
Madam Chair, Tom Melcher with the Department of Education.
Dr. Melcher.
Article 8, Section 1 is amending the Adult Basic Education Funding Formula. The stricken language on 35 lines 3 through 11 is obsolete language that's being removed. The new language on page 35 lines 16 through 19 is establishing an 11% growth factor for an individual program with a minimum of $14,000. The 2006 legislature amended the adult basic education funding formula to provide a 3% annual increase in the level of funding for the program statewide. Our understanding is at the time that was enacted that there was an expectation that programs throughout the state would be receiving an increase roughly of 3%. However, what happened in the actual implementation of this is because some programs were already at this 8% limit, they received a zero increase. So I think there was an unintended effect in the 2006 legislature that wasn't determined until we did the runs on this and determined that a significant number of programs were being excluded from the 3% increase. This is intended to make that increase more uniform across the state by essentially adding 3 percentage points onto the 8% increase that we had as a cap previously. That will allow those programs that had been growing at 11% earlier to add 3 percentage points and would tend to even out the increases across the state.
Madam Chair.
Commissioner Anderson.
Section 2 of this article simply changes the amount reimbursement eligible for the GED assessment. Currently, the state appropriates about $125,000 each year to reimburse partial exam fees for those individuals that qualify. Unfortunately, we haven't been able to allocate or spend all of the appropriation because the $20 cap for an eligible individual is there's not enough individuals to meet that demand. So what we're proposing is not a change to the amount of the appropriation, but rather allowing that an eligible individual could be receive up to $40 reimbursement for the GED exam.
Okay, thank you. And Representative Wardlow has a question. Okay. This is the repealer. Commissioner Anderson, would you explain the repealer first, and then we'll go to Representative Ford.
Madam Chair, Tom Melcher, Department of Education.
Dr. Melcher.
The repealer is repealing an obsolete section of the Adult Basic Education Funding Formula that deals with the calculation of aid for fiscal year 2001.
Thank you, and thank you to the department for the efficient presentation of this bill. I really appreciate that. Representative Wardlow.
Thank you, Madam Chair. When I was looking at page 13 a long time ago, and I purposely waited till now. You know,
that's all right.
In Section 6, it talks about no school district or charter school may prohibit a student from applying to enroll in online learning. I don't know if this is the right place to ask this, but it triggered something from a meeting I went to. And when a student applies for online learning from a provider, does the school district lose money that and then for that student? I'm aware of a school district where kids took so many hours. They took more hours from online learning than they did from the school, but yet the school had lost money and the school had to give them a diploma in the school's name, but they never took any classes from that school, basically.
Dr. Melcher, would you like to answer that question?
Madam Chair and Representative Wardlow, there is a limit on the amount of average daily membership that a student can generate, and if a student generates more than the limit, there is a reduction in the average daily membership. I don't have the statute right in front of me, but my recollection is that that reduction comes first off of the regular average daily membership. So if a student was full-time in a school, they also took an online course, then the regular school would take a reduction to keep them under the limit, is my understanding.
Yeah.
Representative Wardlow.
And then, but the student would still graduate with the diploma from that high school, mm-hmm. with that high school's name on it?
Madam Chair and Representative Wardlow, yes, the student's diploma would come from the school in which they're enrolled as a regular student, where their base enrollment is, even if they took a course from an online program.
What?
Representative Wardlow.
Okay, I'll just be quiet for now.
Commissioner Anderson wants to respond to that. Let's let her respond.
Madam Chair, Representative Wardlow, I will say that students still have to meet state and local requirements for graduation. They're not exempt from those requirements just because they're enrolled in an online learning course or series of courses.
Thank you, Commissioner. Representative Wardlow, did you get your question answered?
Pretty much. I got an amendment in mind. Just never mind right now.
Representative Erickson.
Well, Madam Chair and Representative Wardlow, I think those are questions you can raise in finance because I think that's your issue, is it not?
Representative Wardlow.
Madam Chair, yes, but since I'm not on finance, I had to ask it now.
Madam Chair and Representative Wardlow, I'll make sure I
was just going to say, I bet Representative Erickson would do that for you. Thank you, Representative Erickson. That would help. Okay. Now that we have a good understanding of the bill, now we're going to change it. Representative Mariani, would you like to move your author's amendment?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would move H1197A5.
Members, I think you have that in your packet.
Okay.
We'll go ahead and vote on the amendment so that the author may get...
I think we're going to vote it on, discuss it, and then vote it on, Madam Chair.
Okay, that's fine. So would you like to proceed?
Yes, Madam Chair. This amendment does several things. There are a number of things that the department brought in, and there are a number of things that I generated. Beginning on line 1.2, that refers to the statewide testing and reporting. We're basically going to move the rulemaking part of that to a rulemaking section that we'll create at the end of the bill. And I'm told that, partly for transparency's sake, that it's good practice to have, when we're going to have a rulemaking activity, to have a section at the end of the bill that's entitled rulemaking. Line 1.3 inserts the word appropriate. I believe we did that with, and I may ask for help from counsel here, but I believe we did that in order to line up with language that's used in special ed, where appropriate has a definition in special ed. I'm seeing a nodding of the head, so far I'm doing okay. line 1.4 refers to page 24. I'm sorry, page 9. Madam Chair, this has to do with statewide and local assessments, where we had directed the department to report to us in 2006-2007 a value-added component to measure student achievement and growth over time. We've met with the department about this. They certainly have an intention to report student growth component, but the value-added component, which has, and I'm not the expert here, but has a very specific definition to it, they're not ready to do that. And so they have proposed to strike the word value-added. In checking with some of our colleagues here, we like the word value-added. We know there's reference to it in other statutes, and so we thought another way to do this is to extend the time out And again, talking with the department, there is interest in pursuing value-added components, and so the amendment would reinstate the value-added language and then change the date from 06, 07 to 08, 09. Line 1.7 is another one of those.
Representative Erickson. Thank you, Madam Chair. And may I have the department just comment on the feasibility and efficiency of change, that change?
Good question.
Madam Chair, Representative Erickson.
Sorry.
A lot of times the words growth and value add are confused to mean the same thing, and they're not the same thing. And so we will report student growth. We've integrated, vertically integrated our tests. We're going to go through our stakeholders group to look at scaling and scores and such, and we'll be able to show growth for the 06-07 school year. We will not, however, be able to show value added. That takes a more years of data in order to do that. And so it wasn't the intention that we would never do value added, but value added was in a separate statute, and so we struck value added here because the intention was always growth, not value added growth, because they're mixing two words up. And so we're okay with this language that's being proposed to say that no later than the 08-09 school year that we would then also have value added.
Thank you. Commissioner Anderson.
Madam Chair, line 1.7 is another one of those insertion of appropriate language, the word appropriate to be consistent with special ed language. line 1.8, I'll ask the department to talk about this issue as well as the language from 1.9 and 1.10 through 12.
Commissioner Anderson. Page 10, line 6.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I'm actually going to have our testing director speak to those two provisions. If we can, I can speak to what's listed in 1.9 through 1.12 first. That was actually something inadvertently dropped from the department's policy bill. That is requiring a school district or charter school to place a student's assessment score for 9th grade writing, 10th grade language arts, and 11th grade mathematics on the student's transcript. This is a response from our high school principals and superintendents talking about discussing the issue of how do we have students take seriously the high school state assessments. As you may know, that's not a student accountability test, it's a school accountability test, and there's a lot of feeling amongst administrators that students are not taking it as seriously. So this was one of the recommendations that came out of the group, was to place the score onto the student's transcript.
Thank you, Commissioner. Dr. Mattson.
Madam Chair, I'm over here, Dr. Mattson, saying that she got it right. She hit it right on the nose.
Okay. Delete Dr. Mattson. Thank you.
We support one another marvelously, Madam Chair. In my mind, it does raise some issues about, you know, when you put the information on a transcript, is the intent there to have colleges, employers, be able to have access and look at that, and does that raise any issues in terms of having those entities being able to view this by virtue of acquiring a student's transcript? I don't know if the department would care to comment if you've thought about that or...
Madam Chair,
Mr. Anderson.
Members of the committee, we actually are working quite closely with the University of Higher Education, particularly on our math test, to use that actually as a placement test on college readiness, particularly in math, and we're starting out with math, and working to find out what higher ed wants assurances is a certain placement of score on the MCA math test, what would be that equivalent to our test entrance or placement test to give in math. And so there is an interest in higher ed working with K-12 in eliminating some testing, entrance testing that happens particularly in math, and how our MCAs can be aligned to that. We have a working group in the P15 Council that's working out these issues. And so along with the students' transcripts when they enter college, they also must send their ACT or SAT scores in traditionally. And we think that as long as the student or parent is requesting for that information to be released, that is their decision, and it's consistent with grades, transcripts, ACT scores, SAT scores.
Wonderful. Thank you for that explanation.
And Chair, lines 1.13 through 1.19 are, safe to say, controversial with the department. This has to do with the definition of highly qualified teachers is defined to be aligned and consistent with the NCLB requirements. And Madam Chair, quite frankly, for me, this is just a little bit of sort of drawing a line in the sand, if you will, we'll see how far this goes. But the issue here has to do with the requirement that teachers demonstrate a subject matter competency in each of the core academic subjects for which they're defined under NCLB. And this language would basically leave it open-ended and sort of simplify it to say that the teacher will demonstrate subject matter competency in core academic subjects. This issue may arise, although it doesn't arise quite yet here. I had a brief discussion with Representative Erickson about this issue. May arise in regards to cross-disciplinary licenses. As I understand it, there would be no room for such a thing under NCLB. Of course, we're not doing that currently in the state, but, you know, it's just a little bit of sort of, you know, hair on your back, you know, message to NCLB. I suspect that there's probably a sanction if we don't do this, but, you know, part of me, Madam Chair and members, it's, you know, it's sort of a message about, you know, the sort of what I think is what I would characterize sort of a creeping intrusion of the federal law into decisions that we may make locally that attempt to align teacher licensing with our needs, with our students. And welcome the department's criticism and debate on it.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Bittman, would you like to speak to that?
Madam Chair,
Commissioner Anderson,
Deputy Education Commissioner, we actually have no opposition to his amendment. 97% of our teachers are highly qualified. We have very rigorous standards for teacher licensure in Minnesota. I think the attempt actually here was in 2004, what was known as the house process for those teachers not highly qualified was put into law to try to expedite the process quickly because the 2006 deadline was coming for those teachers. And as we've moved along the process, we'd actually like to delete federal law from state law in our department policy bill. And so it's really doesn't make a difference to us one way or the other.
Okay, thank you, Commissioner. Representative Chairman Mariani, would you like to continue?
Madam Chair, that went amazingly well. Line 21, Section 6. I'm not sure I get this right. Oh, yes. Actually, this...
Chairman Mariani, may we just interrupt you one second? Representative Lane has a question, and it might be to that point, and it might be just better discussed right now.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's just a question. As my understanding is that No Child Left Behind, that actually at the federal level, the federal government has no constitutional authority over education, that's at the state level, and the No Child Left Behind comes along and brings all these rules when we buy the carrot of the money that goes with it. But actually, the federal government is not responsible for education. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Representative, that is correct. The state decided to opt out of the No Child Left or the Elementary and Secondary Education Act. If it did so, then it would forfeit the federal money associated with the program.
Thank you. Chairman Mariani, would you like to continue?
Madam Chair, yes, it's a big carrot that they use quite effectively. Madam Chair, the next section here, Section 6, it's also related to, on the next page, Section 12 on lines 2.8. These were brought by my school district, and my understanding is that these were accepted by the department and adopted into the Senate bill. This has to do with waivers from racial imbalances. If the imbalances are at a school site are created under certain circumstances, and those circumstances include or would be are solely where the school houses an ELL center and where that school is representative of the population of the district's students. And then, of course, you know, as long as the district gives the parents a choice of attending another school. The issue here, as I understand it, is that, you know, it's much more efficient to be able to provide EOL services for students with similar languages in a concentrated school as opposed to spreading them out in order to meet racial imbalance requirements. And then the Section 12 part has to do with the transporting of children to intensive learning centers through the grades served at that school. And I believe the department is okay with this language.
Chair, would Representative Slavik bring treats to the next
meeting? Perhaps.
Chairman Mariani, please continue.
Madam Chair, line 2.6 is the excellent catch that Representative Lane made earlier. We were amazed here when the three of us. And it's hard to amaze Mr. Melcher, so Representative Lane, you did a terrific job. It's a correction in reference to statute. Line 227 actually I think needs a little bit of a technical because there's two ands on that line, and I think what we mean to say is like after this or at the second and. And we could fix that later, I think.
Yeah.
Madam Chair, members, 229, line 229 is rulemaking authority related to the MCA2 and the new the grad test. To accompany that, in reading math and writing, with the commissioner will be adopting rules for implementing and administering those assessments. The original language in the bill, when we reviewed it, we thought it was broad. And we propose using a more restrictive rulemaking authority. I believe the commissioner is okay with that. And members, just, you know, for new members, you know, I mean, this is just sort of, I think, part of being part of the legislative branch. You know, I think we tend to jealously guard whatever powers we confer to other branches of government. And one of the areas in which we do that is through rulemaking authority. And there are a number of us that believe that, to the extent possible, we can use the more restricted rulemaking, that tends to, in our opinion, honor that balance and hopefully still provide good public policy. I see Representative Greiling nodding, who's been my mentor on rulemaking issues. I'll learn one of these days, Representative Greiling. Madam Chair, Section 14 in the amendment, line 3.8, I think is controversial. This has to do with a rulemaking authority conferred on the Board of Teaching in regards to credentialing of paraprofessionals back in the 2003 session. And members, we typically, quite frankly, we typically expect that when we direct entities like the Board of Teaching to implement a rule, to create and implement, we expect them to do it. And this didn't happen. And we can certainly get into a many hours debate around the issue of the credentialing of paraprofessionals. It's not my intent to do that. But I think it is appropriate for us to send a message and a directive back to the Board of Teaching to, in fact, do the rule that both bodies agreed to. The governor signed the bill. In fact, I think Representative Segrin at the time was the chair of the committee and part of the conference committee that approved this. And that,
Chairman Mariani, we have a question from Representative Greiling, if you'd like to take that now.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner Anderson, I'm just looking at this section, and why did we not have a deadline on the rules before? Or I know you're not in charge of the rulemaking, but since you're at the table, why is it that the rule was not promulgated on time, and that we have to take what I would consider a fairly extreme measure here in this section?
Commissioner Anderson.
Madam Chair, Representative Greiling, this is the authority of the Board of Teaching, just to clarify, not the Department of Education. I will say that during the start of the promulgation of that rule, the Department did express concerns because the Board of Teaching, as part of the rulemaking, was going to impose a $57 fee for the credentials. and unfortunately the law did not contain the authority to impose that fee. In 1999, the legislature restricted state agencies from imposing a new fee or increasing a new fee without legislative authority. That is under, let's see, 15. With that, that's under 16A.1283. It states that executive state agencies cannot pose a fee or increase a fee unless authorized by law. And because of that, that's one of the reasons. Because of that, it would have imposed a significant increase or cost onto the Department of Education and the Board of Teaching, because they would have had to build a new system, they would have had to train, they would have had to hire staff, they would have had to process credentials without any revenue to match that. And normally, we do charge $57 for a teacher license fee. We do charge a fee, I can't remember the amount, for administrator's fee. And so we would request that if this rulemaking authority is given, that they also give the authority for the Board of Teaching to impose a fee, because we will run into financial difficulties administering this rule without any revenue to go forward with issuing the credentials or licenses, however it is structured.
Thank you, Commissioner Anderson. Ms. Ballmer, from the Executive Director of Board of Teaching, would like to speak to this issue. Representative Greiling, did you have a question before she gets to the table, or as she gets
here,
to the
I'll
table?
I'll hear what she has to say.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Ballmer, welcome to the committee, and please state your name and position for the record.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Karen Ballmer. I'm the Executive Director for the Minnesota Board of Teaching. Unfortunately, I don't have as much information for you today as I would like to have. I've been with the Board of Teaching just since July of 2006, so I don't have the personal experience on this. I do want to say publicly and on record that the Board of Teaching does take seriously its responsibilities when rulemaking is directed or when rulemaking is undertaken. That's not something that is taken lightly. I do not have the details for you about this specific situation. I do understand this is, I'm apologizing for not being prepared. This was new to me just a few minutes ago. So I will prepare and look into this. I do understand that there were some dynamics, some of which have been already suggested here, having to do with fees and the authority of the board and so on, in compliance with other statutory constraints that they ran into in the process. I do want to commit to you that this is taken seriously by the Board of Teaching, and when we're directed to do something, we will follow through with that. But I don't have the details that you need and deserve today, but I would like to have an opportunity to get that for you.
Thank you, Ms. Ballmer. Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I'm not going to belabor the point on rulemaking. I got lectured by Representative Mariani last time I went on and on about rulemaking in the committee that I have to hold up this whole committee. I'm just going to trust that Representative Mariani has a good history for putting this, because I know he's a gentleman, for putting this strict willful failure language in here. Cause for removal of a board member if the rule isn't done. And I hope we will get the information on why it wasn't done, and especially if there was a deadline, because I don't know if this is related at all to the standards that we need for paraprofessionals for No Child Left Behind, this has piqued my interest to see this strong language in here. I don't know if any, Ms. Allsweiger, if she could fill us in.
Ms. Allsweiger, state your name and position for the record, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Jan Allsweiger, Education, Minnesota, and I do have the whole history, but it doesn't sound like it's necessary, because I think we just heard the department say that they needed some fees, and you could certainly pass, you know, add that additional language in here as necessary, and the Board of Teaching sounds like they're committed to doing the job that they were doing. So it sounds like maybe this is going to be pretty easy to take care of. And we need to further discuss this, I can, you know, bring out the history and what happened or didn't happen. But I'd prefer not to do that if we have commitment from them to get it done.
Okay, thank you. I find that reasonable also. Chairman Mariani, would you like to continue with the A5 amendment?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And again, Madam Chair, just very quickly, I do think it's important for the legislature to guard its authority very seriously here, and when we direct entities that in fact they carry those out, I also don't know the whole history. It could have been that there might have been messages coming back here. I'm not aware of those at those time, but I think Ms. Allswager has offered a very gracious out here, and obviously what we can work with counsel to for language to this effect, and we can maybe even work on getting rid of that willful failure part. It certainly got someone's attention. Madam Chair, members, 316 through 322, I'll have the department speak on that issue. This is a good, really good amendment.
Madam Chair, members of the committee,
Commissioner Anderson,
Deputy Education Commissioner, this comes to us from a number of concerns and complaints we've received from the military, the National Guard, and actually those serving overseas. Many have attempted to look at their futures and looking at post-secondary education when they get back from Iraq or Afghanistan or wherever they're located, and they're trying to apply while they're overseas, apply to a higher education institution in Minnesota, but we have been in the unfortunate situation of trying to facilitate the paying of and obtaining of student transcripts, and normally it's a $3 to $5 fee. And what's happening is that the in many cases the school district's requesting that the person write out a check themselves or personally take care of it, and they can't always personally take care of those things while they're serving overseas. So this language would exempt or would require that would require school boards that could not charge a fee to a person serving in active military service for requesting a copy of their transcript. It would just solve a lot of problems that's happening of those overseas that are requesting to move into post-secondary and trying to get transcripts and having a difficult time doing that and having the military and the department try to facilitate situations.
Okay, thank you, Commissioner.
Madam Chair, line 323 would delete section 6. This has to do with language to create a unified administrative structure for integrating early childhood education. And among other things, it has language in there, in the department bill has language that this would include other relevant public or private entities. We're not quite sure who the private entities are, and it raises some concerns for me. I could tell you, members, if you recall, Representative Thiessen, we teed this bill up to be heard in this committee. I believe you heard testimony. I don't think we moved. I think he pulled the bill. The bill does not have a Senate file. We're not aware of any advocates for this provision. We know that there are other bills that have moved along to Representative Slava's committee that takes different swipes of this. And so we thought, particularly sort of the wariness around the private entities part, we thought when we added all that together that we would just remove this language from the bill.
With that, are you...
Madam Chair, line 324 is keeping the MELF. We heard about MELF earlier. Part of this comes from a awareness that we have passed bills here, and there are bills out there that refer to MELF, and we wanted to make sure that there was some careful alignment happening with those bills and this. And so at least for the time being, we want to be able to keep this language here, and then we'll do the adjustment. We'll work with the department and MELF in this regard and arrive at a good accommodation.
Madam Chair, Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Would the department again tell us what it is that the Minnesota Learning Early Learning Foundation has been in discussion with you?
Ms. Carlson, please state your name and position for the record, please.
Madam Chair and members, Karen Carlson with the Department of Education. Madam Chair and Representative Erickson, the reason that we propose to repeal is because the language would set us up for having a law that we couldn't follow because the MELF has decided to just be a private board. So we thought that the repeal of, and also it does have a reference to the North Star quality rating system, which the quality rating system is still in effect, but it's not a North Star one. It didn't change. So we just thought it was made more sense to repeal it. And then I just talked with Chair Slawick, and we can, I think we should repeal the, or get delete the language and put language in that you want to have, what you want to say in here, because it's just a little messy to keep, but we'll keep the language until we can replace it.
Madam Chair, I was
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would think that that would be the best strategy to use right now.
Okay.
Is to agree with the department on the repealer and then move forward with the discussions that will go on between the department and MILF and Ms. Lowick's committee.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Erickson. We have...
in other words, Madam Chair, I would like to delete line 3.24. Remove that from the author's amendment, and I move that.
An oral amendment?
Yes, I'm proposing an oral amendment.
Chairman Mariani, would you consider that a friendly amendment?
Madam Chair, I would ask for Representative Slawick to provide some advice here.
Madam Chair, and Representative Mariani, the department and I just talked about this in the hallway, that the issue is that we're actually looking at doing potential pilot programs for MILF.
Yes.
And we want to have a mechanism to do that. I have just been looking at the statute as well, and it does have a lot of specific reporting requirements that were put in statute when we thought MILF was going to be one thing. Clearly, it's another. You know, frankly, we would like to keep it in place so that we can replace it with language instead of completely having it come out, because at least it has a reference to MILF in there. So our preference is not to do that, but to keep the language in there until we can come up with replacement language to replace that. So I guess I would speak against the amendment.
Okay.
Madam Chair,
Representative Erickson.
Now, Madam Chair, go ahead and ask the author of the amendment, and then I'll reinstate mine.
Chairman Mariani.
Madam Chair, I appreciate the spirit in which Representative Erickson offers this, and I suspect as we get down the line there will be changes here, but I would agree with Representative Slawick and ask the staff to make the change at this point.
Okay, thank you.
Madam Chair, I would like to offer my oral amendment, though, and call for a roll call.
Representative Erickson, once we adopt the amendment, we can ask for the oral amendment.
Okay.
Thank you.
This will be during discussion, and thank you.
Yes, thank you.
Madam Chair, I believe there's some technical changes to the amendment that that Council Larson has been working on, and I'm wondering if we're perhaps at a point where we can offer those to the amendment. So.
Madam Chair, members, thank you. If you'll bear with me, I'd like to make a few changes on the document H119785. I believe these are all changes that have come up as a result of discussions, questioned by members, discussions with the department, and I'd be glad to go through them with you.
Would you please?
The first one on the document would be on page 1, right after line 1, insert, and if you'd like to turn to page 5, you can see this. Page 5, line 14, delete or and insert a comma. And after school, insert or non-public school. I understand from the department that the direction with respect to education records was intended to apply to districts, charter schools, and non-public schools, and I think it was simply an omission not to include non-public schools in that at the beginning of the sentence on line 14. Okay. Oh, and yes, thank you. And that was a question raised by Representative Tilbury.
Ms. Larson, are you done?
No.
Oh.
Okay. The next change is on page 2 of the document, after line 5. It reflects a change in page 16 of your house file. And this was a question. Ward. This is in response to a question that Representative Ward raised. So on page 2 of the amendment, after line 5, insert, page 16, line 17, after records, insert, comma, within 10 business days of closure, comma. Okay, then on page 2, line 27, And you need to turn to page 18 in your bill. Representative Mariani pointed out that that there are two ands on line 17, so it should read page 18, line 17, delete the second and. And then on your amendment, page 3, after line 15, this is with respect to the ability to charge fees, insert paragraph C, the Board of Teaching may charge fees to issue new licenses and to renew licenses for paraprofessionals issued licenses under the rules adopted under this section.
Ms. Larson, would you please repeat that?
Okay. On
starting page, please.
Yeah, on page 3 of your amendment, after line 15, it's to insert a new paragraph C. The Board of Teaching may charge fees to issue new licenses and to renew licenses for paraprofessionals issued licenses under the rules adopted under this section.
Madam Chair.
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, I'm wondering if the word license should be replaced with the word credential, and I would want Education Minnesota to comment on that. Actually, give me the thumbs up. I'm assuming that's good, but instead of the word license, yes, have credential.
Okay, Ms. Larson, then would you please reread the amendment one more time? Thank you.
Yes, absolutely. Madam Chair, members, on page 3 of your document, after line 15, insert paragraph C, the Board of Teaching may charge fees to issue new credentials and to renew credentials for paraprofessionals issued credentials under the rules adopted under this section.
That's a lot of credentials. Thank you. Does anybody need that repeated again? I can. Okay. Mr. Strom.
Madam Chair, members, and Mr. Melcher may want to address this as well. There's been a bit of discussion within the department about the meaning of the words care and treatment. On page 20, line 11 of your bill draft, I believe the preferred reference from the department here would be to delete those words and just have the reference be to a site approved under section 125A515. So the amendment would be amended to delete the words care and treatment. And Mr. Melcher may want to comment on that.
Dr. Melcher.
Madam Chair, Tom Melcher for the Department of Education. We would agree with that.
Okay, thank you. Ms. Larson.
Madam Chair, members, the next change on your amendment is on page 3, again, after line 16, and it pertains to language that appears on page 27 of your bill. It's language the department is offering about data generated by the commissioner, and I asked Commissioner Anderson about this because I couldn't quite capture the meaning of the sentence. Essentially, the sentence currently reads, the data...
Ms. Larson, you're on page 27, correct?
Yes, on and line 14.
Okay, thank you.
The data generated, et cetera, by the commissioner is confidential data, except those that are required by Subdivision 7 are confidential data. And so I think the sentence needs to be rewritten. So if you'd follow along with me, I think we could do it this way. Page 27, line 15, delete, comma, except. Page 27, line 16, delete those that are required by subdivision 7-2B and insert and maybe. And after agency, insert under subdivision 7. Because as I understand it, the whole point of this is to allow the department to transmit confidential data to local law enforcement agencies.
Commissioner Anderson.
Madam Chair, I agree with Ms. Larson's changes, and we have no issues with that. I think the intent was all the same. It's just worded better to reflect that.
Okay, Ms. Larson.
Yes, Madam Chair, members, then we need to make a similar change in the second sentence beginning on page 17. So on page 27 of your bill, line 18, delete semicolon except those that are required by subdivision 7 to B and insert may be. And on page 27, line 19, after agency, insert under subdivision 7.
Ms. Larson, do you have another change?
Madam Chair, surprisingly, no.
What a shame. Okay. Chairman Mariani, would you entertain those changes to your amendment?
Madam Chair, I would incorporate those changes into the A5 amendment.
We had two other questions before we moved the amendment, and they were from Representative Peterson. One from Representative Peterson. That was a good strategy I had, wasn't it? Representative Dabney.
Madam Chair, Deputy Commissioner Anderson, I'm looking at the language on page 3, lines 18 through 22.
Are you on the bill now? Or the
I'm on the amendment, ma'am.
Thank you.
And I'm noticing at least one glaring omission, and then I've got a second question. The omission is that we don't include private schools. And certainly some members of our military probably attended private schools and are also looking at their future. And secondly, are you moving any similar sort of provision in the higher ed area? Because I would imagine some of them have done some form of higher education and are looking at additional schooling or completing their schooling along the same track or a different track.
Madam Chair, Representative Dabley, that's your first question. I would have no problem adding. We'd have no problem adding non-publics if that's what you wish. On your second question, we're amending basically the school fee law, anything on fees in higher ed would be a separate section for a separate committee. We have submitted information to our Office of Higher Education of the issue about transcripts and fees, and so we leave that to their responsibility. I think they might get a little bit upset if we start amending their fee laws in K-12 or the Department of Education, but that issue has been noted, and hopefully they may take that up.
Madam Chair, Joe, just to clarify for Ms. Anderson, my question was whether you were pursuing that in higher ed. I wasn't going to do exactly what you described here for all the obvious reasons you described.
Thank you, Representative. I appreciate that.
However, I think Ms. Larson is going to help me with the inclusion of private schools in this provision.
So, Ms. Larson, prepared to do that right now?
Madam Chair, members, would be kind enough to give us a few minutes, because the problem with the language on your amendment, page 3, line 33, that covers, as Ms. Anderson said, the public school fee law. So we're going to have to put the public school language someplace else, probably in chapter 133.
Okay.
Good. Thank you.
In the meantime, Representative Wardlow has a question. Representative Wardlow.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Since Representative Dabney brought this up, I had been thinking about it. In that section referring to the military people, maybe Representative Mariani, there's no time frame in there. Does that mean they have to be on active duty? I'm thinking of the soldier Marine who comes off active duty. He's done his 4 years and he wants to go back to school. Is at what point can he not ask for the waiver of the transfer, and does it not include, for instance, I know someone who's getting a second degree because the Marine Corps doesn't want him anymore, and because of health reasons, and he's getting another degree, and he had a whole bunch of transcripts to get sent from Augsburg and other places, and just food for thought there. I don't know if you want to get into that, and maybe we're imposing on the higher institutions where they don't want to waive fees like that either. But
Representative Wardlow, I'd just like to remind everyone that this bill will be going to
K-12 finance, and now Representative Wardlaw, I remember you're not on K-12 finance.
It's just food for, Madam Chair?
Yeah.
It's just food for thought for the next committee, that's all.
Good. I bet Representative Erickson will take your thoughts forward. Thank you. Ms. Larson, are we prepared yet?
Madam Chair? You do have a,
Chairman Mariani.
I'm sure you do have an amendment that Senator Erickson, I think, is going to offer.
We need to move the amendment first before we.
It's Friday.
Yes. Everybody's faces are reminding me that. Chairman Mariani, Mr. Chairman, what we will do is we are going to go ahead and move your amendment, and then the amendment that Ms. Larson brings forward, we will amend the amendment. So let's start. Let's proceed. Would you like to move Amendment A5?
Madam Chair, I would so move.
So moved. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Amendment A5 is adopted. Ms. Larson, are you tired of me yet? Yes. Representative Erickson, would you like to present your oral amendment?
Well, Madam Chair, I was just a little confused here about the procedure, but Madam Chair, I'm not going to offer my amendment, but I do want to say this, that NELF has decided, the Minnesota Early Learning Foundation has decided that they can be more effective operating privately, and if we want to have grants that we give to them, then I think we need to deal with that separately. But this discussion will continue, and I will, visit with the other committee chairs, like Representative Slawick, and the department, as well as Dwayne Benson, to see what is going to be most effective. Because I think if we do not help NELF move forward, they're going to get caught up in the whole bureaucracy of a public-private partnership, and they have so many ideas they want to go forth with. We want them to do their research, and that's just the statement I want to make, but I won't offer my amendment.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Erickson. Ms. Larson.
Madam Chair, members. Madam Chair, members, on your amendment, page 2, it would be right after line 5, insert. Page 13, after line 5, insert. And then this is what we're going to, in fact, insert. Section 7, the head note would read non-public transcripts. The coding would be 123B.485. And the section would read, a non-public school that receives services or aid under sections 123B.40 to 123B.48 must not charge a fee, and then we'll parrot the language that already appears in the amendment, to a person serving an active military service under section 190.05 subdivision 5 who requests that the non-public school transmit a copy of the person's transcript to a post-secondary institution or prospective employer. The non-public school may request reasonable proof of the service member's current military status.
Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll move that amendment.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The amendment is adopted. Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Yes. Chairman Mariani.
I have another amendment. Madam Chair, I want to offer the A1 amendment.
Chairman Mariani, would you like to explain the amendment?
I will try my best, Madam Chair, and I will try to do this quickly. I'm mindful we have a number of other bills and testifiers here with us today. Madam Chair, there's a tension that exists between the applicability, if you will, of the within the alternative teacher pay statute, what we know as QCOP, between the performance indicators that that calls for, not the indicators, but the pay based on performance that that calls for, and what we have traditionally used in this state, which are the experience and educational credits, which, by the way, I'm told are not existed in statute. They are creatures of agreements historically between districts and our teacher our teacher unions. This was a big issue, apparently. I wasn't involved, but this was a big issue a few years ago when we enacted the QCOP legislation. And the issue of the tension between fitting the steps and lanes framework with the new proposed framework. And kind of depending on who you talk to, you kind of get slightly different stories on how that came out. And so to some degree, members, I venture into this a little timidly because I suspect that we're dealing with issues here that perhaps have to do with some vagueness in the law. This amendment will attempt to do two things. First of all, if in fact QCOP was meant to be a supplement to the teacher compensation pay increases, then the language on 1.5 attempts to clarify that. It attempts to say, or it says that in a restructured alternative teacher professional pay system, that includes pay based on components in addition to experience and educational credits. That language is intended by this author to reflect an understanding that this alternative pay system is a supplemental approach to this whole area. The other language on the flip side of the amendment here starts really with the line with the word in my mind with the word reform on line 2.1. And you know, it's interesting. I think if you ask 10 people what reform means, I think you might get 10 different definitions, and I think that's kind of where, you know, past legislatures maybe have left us with a reasonable, you know, doubt as to interpretation of the mix between steps and lanes and the performance pay mechanism. And so, as I looked at this language, and I don't claim that I fully understand this, and I'll circle back to that comment a little bit later, but it seemed to me that if we're going to have 60% of any new compensation increases related to the performance indicators fit within a reform, you know, approach, then it was a little confusing to me in terms of how that works with the mix of steps and lanes and this performance pay. And it seemed to me that particularly as you get out into the steps and lane you know, framework, that we kind of de facto wind up replacing the adjustments and steps and lanes over time as opposed to creating a true incentive. And there are scenarios that people far smarter than I am and who have no partisan or, you know, are purely objective on this, there are scenarios where one can create an outcome where, in fact, there may be limiting, you know, factors in terms of introducing pay adjustments into the future that's set up by the language that we have here. Members, and let me just say this, that this may not make me most popular with most folks here, but I actually like the concept of a performance using some elements of good performance indicators as part of teacher pay increases. I'm not totally a free market guy, but I think there's some powerful elements there. This amendment makes a first attempt to try to provide some clarity to this. I'm not sure that I've done it, I wanted to get this out here, and this is a serious issue. There are some other issues here, but there are some real tensions. I'm struck by, whenever you carve out something new, that we struggle with trying to find the right balance of how do you bring along people who are vested, rightfully so, vested in an existing system to buy into the new system. And I do think that perhaps in 2003 our legislators were trying to find some kind of a mix that would preserve some elements of the existing system with this new concept, mindful that you can't often expect people overnight to drop one system and adopt another. And so I don't want to ascribe any negative motivations to anyone in regards to the development of this law. My only attempt here is to try to, in fact, stick to some notion of reform and balance that does have a cogent and understandable and fair mix of the quote-unquote specs and lanes and the teacher performance pay based on the indicators and statute. Madam Chair, I don't want to debate this long today. We're late.
Yes.
We do have testifiers who have hung around, and I want to thank them for doing that. But I want to at least get this out here. Let's talk about this, and then proceed from there. This is an issue that's not going to go away. Madam Chair, with that, let me just stop there, and I certainly would love to hear from initial thoughts from the department and other legislators.
Commissioner Anderson.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I will be really brief because I know the time has gone on a long, but the department opposes this amendment. The department is currently in litigation over these issues. Both the briefs have been filed to the court. We expect there will be a hearing and resolution this spring or summer that will provide clarity to to the issue. And we would just prefer that process to continue rather than making changes to the statute.
Chairman Mariani, did I hear you correctly saying that you think that this needs to be opened up in a different venue at a different time in under a larger framework?
Well, Madam Chair, I think so. I am inviting, and I know I'm testing the patience of the public who's come here on other bills, but I am inviting some vetting at this point. I don't think we need to do it long, but...
Thank you. Representative Ward has a question or a comment then.
Well, to the amendment, are you asking that the amendment be passed, or does it, Chairman Mariani? Are you going to pass it? Are we asking to pass this?
Well, Representative Ward, if I tell you yes, then lots of people will try to vet it. If I tell you no, people just, say nothing. And
oh, okay, then let me make some statements then. As an educator that just came off of working with this QCOMP for a few years, first of all, and I'm not going to debate it for long either unless we want to, initially, most educators would agree that we wish that the dollars spent in QCOMP could have gone to all the school districts within the state of Minnesota, thereby enhancing all the children in the state of Minnesota, which wasn't enough for it to do that. But let me speak to the amendment. If if I read this right, what it says is, in the first part in subdivision one, that includes pay based on components in addition to experience and educational credits. So if I'm reading this right, are we saying that the other, is there reason to believe that the people that are on a Q-comp right now are locked in at a certain point, and that steps and lanes and experience will not advance with Q-comp? Is that why we have this piece of this amendment?
Chairman Mariani.
Madam Chair, Representative Ward, I'm probably quickly going to run into an area where I won't have the answers to this. The intent of this language is to clarify one interpretation of what happened in 2003,
okay,
which is that in effect, QCOP in when applied was not meant to replace or supplant steps and lanes.
Well,
Representative Ward.
Does anybody, do we have anybody in here that knows if that, if my question is, it can be answered to the point of, are we lucky?
Madam Chair, I would certainly welcome folks in the audience if they wish to comment on this to do so.
Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm not sure whether Representative Ward, what he's saying, but as I read this, and at least from what I'm hearing from districts around the state, is that they feel that they should be able to retain, and they feel the language says that they can retain some of the steps and lanes, that process that they've, or the structure they've had in place, and then you add the reform or QCOMP on, you know, on top of that. And I think some districts have done a good job of integrating both. And then you get, as Representative Mariani said, you get a very, it's an incentive for people to do this. And I think districts that have had the feeling they've had to throw out all the structure that's in place and jump into something new without some kind of transition and without some kind of previous structure, we'll probably vote it down. So as I read this, it says in the future, this just clarifies that you can use steps and lanes and build a QCOMP along with that. But I would certainly refer to the people who are at the table.
Before we go on to other questions from other representatives, I'm going to call on Jan Alschweiger.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, Jan Alschweiger, Education Minnesota. If you will recall the history, and I know we've gotten a lot of new people on this committee, but the House version of the bill said, the QCOMP bill said, eliminate steps and lanes. The Senate had nothing about that, and they changed it in a compromise to reform steps and lanes. Education Minnesota would not have agreed to any language if it said eliminate steps and lanes. The problem, and we support Representative Mariani's bill because the problem is some districts are not getting their applications approved because their interpretation is eliminate. And I think that this clarifies what reform can and could mean, and actually from my involvement in the discussions clarifies the intent of the legislation as it was discussed, certainly in my presence and in committee.
Yes, I recall that also. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I just want to...
Commissioner Anderson.
Just also add to that that one of the reasons why the word eliminate was not agreed to and that was included in the House bill is that many thought that the intent was that there would be no salary schedule for teachers and that simply it would be just based on moving up based on performance indicators, and that was never the intention of the original legislation as proposed to have no salary schedule for any teacher. And so what I think the negotiators attempted to do was try to find a word that would say, yes, you can keep the salary schedule, and yes, some of the things in steps and lanes may be retained, but it wouldn't be steps and lanes and then a separate pay system, that there needs to be some interaction with the pay system. And many districts have kept, for instance, educational credits, or they have made cost of living adjustments. Every district negotiates different salary schedules with their teachers, and I think Rose Hermanson from Minneapolis can talk about what Minneapolis did, but we always reserve that issue of the details of what the salary schedule looked like to be with the districts and teachers.
Ms. Hermanson.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Rose Hermanson with Minneapolis Teachers. I wasn't fully prepared to talk to this subject today, but I will share just brief information. Minneapolis is unique in that we are not only doing QCOMP, we're also doing TAP, which is a federally funded program, and we're still doing the original professional pay that was instituted under Governor Ventura. So we have three besides our regular salary schedule. The difference, I think, with Minneapolis than most other districts is we did not necessarily vote as an entire district to go into QCOMP, and that's allowable in the sense that you can have individual schools going in. And so because of that, we have had to retain a salary schedule for the school sites that are not participating in QCOMP. And we have had to meet the requirements in statute for QCOMP as well as participate in the requirements under TAP. I am not going to take a lot of time to talk about the uniqueness of Minneapolis today, but suffice it to say that there are elements of what was the original steps and lanes still in existence in our district. And I would be happy when I can get more details, because we have all these different things going on, to share that with you. I think the teachers as a whole are open to new ways of looking at pay. There is a great deal of comfort in the traditional steps and lanes or credits, and there's a lot of value in the credits because most frequently teachers are taking courses. And in the case of Minneapolis and the ProPay, we were doing action research that was part of gaining the additional pay under the original ProPay plan that we instituted. So I would, I think the discussion is good. I think we do need to get this clarified. We've got a lot of experience under several different methodologies here. And I just for clarifying for the committee, I also have been working at, well, not recently, but some of the original QCOMP applications that came in, they invited me to come in and help read those applications. And there are different structures out there, and however we can work to improve the communication so that people understand clearly what would be acceptable and how we can communicate that to teachers and districts that might want to get involved in this program, I think we need to do that.
Thank you for those thoughtful thoughts. Representative Mariani, is it your intention to move this amendment?
Madam Chair, I do not want to move this amendment today. I would like to hear from my colleague and our lead Republican, Representative Erickson, on this. And then at that point, it'll be my intention to pull this. We'll be revisiting this, and then I think we should get on with the rest of the agenda here today.
Thank you, Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Mariani. I would, of course, oppose this amendment. But one thing, I do think we can have some discussion, but for certain I would request that Education Minnesota provide me with its brief that they would have filed in the lawsuit that's going on, because I have the state's brief, but I do not have a brief from Education Minnesota. And I think to really weigh the pros and cons of what's trying to be accomplished here, I would need a copy of the brief, and I think committee members should also see that brief. So please, Education Minnesota, provide us with that brief. Aside from that, I'm not sure if Representative Peterson and Representative Wardlow were part of the discussion on quality compensation. But quality compensation, at least in the mind of the House majority at the time, was a restructuring, a reforming, a move to a performance pay that certainly would take into account experience and education, but not in the format that those of us who have taught know it as steps and lanes, horizontally and vertically, that at the end of a restructuring of teacher pay, the focus would be on what we are, number one, doing to move student learning ahead, And that's, you know, in a both growth and value-added model at some point. But to really instill in teachers more of a professional approach to our career, to our teaching career. And that, I believed, was not being accomplished in simply having steps and lanes. So we worked diligently for a long time, and yes, we reached a compromise because we in the House majority wanted to eliminate steps and lanes, and of course, Education Minnesota wouldn't agree to that. But if you notice the language, you know, we're trying to improve knowledge, instructional skills, to improve student learning. And we're trying to recruit and retain highly qualified teachers. And as a teacher, what I heard most from my students who advanced into schools of education was that there was no incentive for them to really improve, to really move toward degrees, for example, in their content rather than degrees in our master's in curriculum. And so they looked for something that would be a more motivating for them to pursue the teaching career. And, of course, also to take on challenging assignments within our profession. Whether that was, you know, the design of a master teacher or not was up to the district. And I know Brainerd worked very diligently, and I've looked at your plan, and it's very good. And it's what you, as teachers, designed representative board. It didn't come from the top down. It came from within. And St. Francis is another very good example. So I think Brainerd and St. Francis can be held up as really good models. But with that said, Madam Chair, I will await further debate on this and appreciate Representative Mariani's not asking for a vote on this amendment today so that we can pursue to have discussions with both the department and can review the briefs of both the state and the Education Minnesota.
Thank you, Representative Erickson. Members, I'm going to ask you to prepare your remarks, questions, before I call on you, just so that we can keep this discussion short. I have three other representatives who would like to speak to this issue, so I'm going to call on them. Representative Lane.
Just a short comment. I'm sitting here chomping at the bit to just simply say I really applaud this. I think it's very good, and I know the teachers will always seek, with a little bit of help of time, and if you add a little incentive of money, to improve. I don't have any problem with that happening at all. That's what teachers know and believe and live by. I was very concerned about this when it passed before, and I really, really like your changes here. Simple and clear. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Slocum. Representative Benson.
I will also pass. Thanks.
Okay. Chairman Mariani, did you have some comments?
Very brief. Madam Chair and members, thank you for at least the beginning of this discussion. I think there is need for clarification here. I think that there are some holes in the existing, the way the statute is currently written. I would hope that we can work toward better language here in the near future. With that, Madam Chair, I'm going to withdraw the A1 amendment, and I would like to renew my motion, unless you have a call for audience members to comment on the bill, perhaps you should do that. I withdraw the A1 amendment.
Okay, thank you. And Representative Mariani renews his motion that House File 1197 be recommended to pass as amended. And be re-recommended to the Finance Committee with further recommendation to be re-referred to the K-12 Finance Committee. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The bill is, the motion passes. Thank you. I earned my pay today. That's all I can say. You can't, buddy.
Members, House File 1699, Representative Peterson. And I'm told, I was told, Representative Peterson, that you would love to do this very quickly.
Wow.
Representative Peterson, we probably surprised you, so if you're not ready, we can certainly move on to the other bill. Okay, good. Representative Peterson moves that House File 1699 be recommended to pass and referred to the Finance Committee or re-referral to the K-12 Finance Committee. Representative Peterson, your bill is before us.
Thank you very much. For moving the bill, and I was told I have 5 minutes, and I don't even have any testifiers, so this is going to go fast. It is a bill that establishes grants for counseling for high need public schools, and you can see the brief overview. It basically, as you know, when you have a high school that has high mobility, rates. Of 25% or more, that they will be able to get a grant, and that would be on a first come, first served basis. I don't know if you need more explanation. Any questions?
Are there any questions, Representative Wardlaw?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Peterson, I was just curious. The bill talks about mobility, but the title on section or line 1.5 or 1.6 is high need. I'm just wondering, because need could mean more than just mobility.
Representative Peterson.
Sorry, Mr. Chair. When we talk about high need, in this case it's mobility, because when you've got a high school, say, of 2,300 students and a third of them or even a fourth of them are moving, you need extra help with counseling.
Representative Wardlaw.
I agree. I'm just wondering why not just call it high mobility instead of high needs.
Representative Peterson, I think this Representative Wardlaw probably identifies a good point here.
Mr. Chair, I'm open to changing the title.
And Representative Peterson, what we're really interested is in the language in the body of the, but still, I believe you have an oral amendment.
I have an oral amendment, and it's in line 1.11, and it would say after 25% you would add, and has a student population of 100 or more students in grades 9 through 12. And then in line 1.13, after the 25, the same thing, after the 25%, you would add, has a student population of 100 or more students in grades 7, enrolled in grades 7 through 12.
Do members have that amendment? We could ask our counsel to read it back to us in a second here. Ms. Larson.
Madam Chair, members, on page 1, line 11, after percent, and also on page 1, line 13, after percent, insert, and has a student population of 100 or more students enrolled in grades 7 to 12.
Was it 7 or 9, Representative Peterson?
7 through 12.
Very good. Members, any discussion on the amendment? All in favor of the amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. The bill is amended. Is there anyone in the audience that wishes to testify on the bill? Any further questions? If not, Representative Peterson renews her motion that House File 1699 as amended be recommended to pass and referred to Finance with our further recommendation that it be re-referred to the K-12 Finance Committee. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Peterson. You and Representative Morgan are, I think, tied for first place. So Representative Bly, House File 779. Representative Bly, I apologize to you, sir, and to your testifiers. For the long wait, we started late, and my bill unfortunately went longer than I had thought. I guess I'm not as an efficient bill presenter as the rest of the committee members are. Thank you for your patience and for waiting. Representative Bly, I'm going to move House File 799, I'm going to need some help here, be recommended to pass and referred to Finance Committee. K-12. All right. At this point, we'll leave it at that. So, recommended to pass and referred to Finance. Representative Bly, welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record and then have your good presenters, who I know well, also identify themselves and let's hear your testimony.
Yes, I'm Representative David Bly, and just for the record, if it's House File 779, I believe, I do have a delete all amendment. The amendment is A07-0235X, and I believe you were given copies of that.
Representative Bly, you know, it's late, so I may have been misspoke. I think I meant that I should be moving the bill. Did I do that? Did I move it? Okay.
I think you did.
Boy, I'll tell you. Representative Bly, I will move your author's amendment A07-0235X. Is that correct?
Yes.
Great. So I will move that. That's before us. Is this a, this is a delete?
Yes.
All amendments, so this will put the bill in the shape that you want us to look at it. So members, all in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. The bill is before us in the delete all amendment form.
Thank you for, Chairman and members for hearing this important bill. It is a bill, I think, that not only because of the lateness of the hour, but because of its subject is of urgency. There are three thoughts about the bill that I want to address, and then I will ask my testifiers to speak to the bill. And we can take any questions if there's time. First of all, the bill establishes a council on the indigenous languages language with an executive director. Membership of the council would consist of a representative from each of the 11 tribes in the state and 10 members from the Indian communities. The 10 Indian community members shall be selected by DOLRA, Dakota Ojibwe Language Revitalization Alliance. The council will elect a chair and select an executive director. The council will give focus to the issue of language preservation and have the capacity to seek and receive money from a variety of sources to distribute grants that support the efforts of preserving the Dakota and Ojibwe language. Establish priorities and criteria for the distribution of the grants. The duties are described in sections 2 and 3. And we believe that the appropriation for that council would be roughly between $200,000 and $400,000. Secondly, the council will promote language immersion pathways as a means for preservation. The Ojibwe and Dakota languages are vital parts of Minnesota's legacy. The land where Minnesota is located is the homeland of the Dakota and Ojibwe people. There are a small number of Ojibwe fluent speakers left and far fewer Dakota fluent speakers. Language immersion is a proven method for multiplying the number of native speakers in a relatively short period of time. There are in existence some immersion programs in the state, and they show great promise in it, and it is hoped that the effort would not only support them, but expand their work and create immersion language pathways for Native American children. Studies have consistently shown that indigenous language immersion programs create family and community stability, better academic outcomes, greater family engagement, and greater percent of student success and students going on to higher education. Thirdly, we believe that having a council with this focus holds the best promise for closing the achievement gap. Language revitalization will have a positive impact on the achievement gap if we create immersion pathways. This is the reason for the need to access funding from early childhood, K-12, and higher education as we create, where needed, those immersion pathways for indigenous language speakers through the establishment of grants, including teacher training programs to train Native American teachers to teach in all subject areas in their native languages. It is our belief that the council is necessary to give focus in this way to these concerns to promote language immersion, build the awareness of the need, attract funding from a variety of sources, and help create the capacity to create the programs needed to preserve and sustain the Dakota and Ojibwe languages. I also want to thank various staff members and the representative from DOLRA, as well as people from the Department of Education and tribal members as well, who met with us to clean up the language and bring the bill to you in the present form. With that, I'd like to turn it over to John Papar.
Thank you, Representative Bly. Welcome, Mr. Poupart. Welcome to the committee. It's a pleasure to see you, as always. Please identify yourself for the record and give us your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is John Poupart. I'm a resident of West St. Paul. I work in St. Paul at American Indian Policy Center. My comments are going to be brief and focus on the cultural and spiritual aspects of this legislation and what it has to do with education. The native language, if one might say it, is the crucible of our people's education. If we can retrieve and restore it, it can lend support to lessening our indicators such as the dropout rates, the improve the graduation rates, improve test scores, and here are the high absenteeism rates of our Indian students throughout the nation, not only Minnesota or not only the Twin Cities. Since time immemorial, the spoken word defined our oral history and how we depended upon our culture and our spirituality for survival. It's due to those qualities that I'm still able to come here today at this advanced age to tell you these things.
Just a few years ahead of you, Mr. Pupar.
Attempts by boarding schools to destroy our native institutions of family, clan, tribal structure, and belief systems, including our native language, have been a tragedy that visited our people. So we've survived that, and today we rely once again upon the language. This is where it's important for our identity. This is where our creation stories lie, where the roots of our sacred ceremonies and our values and social norms are rooted. Our children need this spiritual and cultural reinforcement so that it results in improved self-esteem and more confidence among the students. And then they can go on to survive as we have, to improve their attendance of grades and ultimately graduate from high school. Thank you very much for allowing me to.
Thank you, Mr. Pupar. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record and give us your testimony.
My name is Jennifer Bendixson, and I'm a member of the Dakota Ojibwe Language Revitalization Alliance. Chairman Mariani and committee members, let me begin by asking you two crucial questions. How can the Dakota and Ojibwe languages be saved? And how can we use our languages to help close the achievement gap for our children? We can look to the success of the Hawaiian and Maori language programs to provide an answer. Native Hawaiian children in immersion experiences outperform the average for Native Hawaiian children. The Maori tribes in New Zealand went from a 5 to 15% passing rate to a soaring 75% when students were involved in language immersion. In our own area, a test was used by the Wichoye Nandagigadan Project in South Minneapolis doing immersion in three preschool programs using the Individual Growth Development Indicators, or IGDs. This test was administered to all the children in the centers at the beginning of the project. Recently, when tested, the children in the immersion tested twice as high as the non-immersion children. Success for our children must be framed in terms of how well they do in our schools and in our communities. Without language, high dropout rates for our young people will persist. Self-esteem and self-identity will continue to suffer, and an ongoing tragedy of the high numbers of suicide amongst our young people. Minnesota advertises as a state that is committed to the education of Indian children, but it also advertises as a state that helped pull the languages of the Ojibwe and Dakota back from the brink of extinction. In passing this bill, we can together project our shared concerns about saving Minnesota's first languages and helping Dakota and Ojibwe children succeed in our school. Kidama yaye, me switch.
Thank you, Ms. Bendixson. Representative Bly.
So I hope that that we can get the support of the committee to move this bill forward. I did want to make one comment that we did make several handouts that I hope that you'll have time to look over that support what we are talking about. There was a handout that described the bill and referenced the Tribal of Indian Affairs, and I just wanted to make sure that was in error, that was describing the previous bill in its earlier state. And I've learned that sometimes even subtle miscues can create bad feelings, and I want to make sure that there's clarity about that the bill in its present form is the bill that we want to move forward.
Thank you. We do have a question for Representative Erickson, and I'm going to ask the folks if there's anyone that wishes to testify on the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Bly, why wouldn't this be a good responsibility of the Minnesota Indian Affairs Council rather than work this through state statute?
Representative Bly.
I think there are several reasons. The first being that the Indian Affairs Council is in a situation where they are undergoing kind of reorganization, and they did not feel that it was a timely thing for them to take us on. I also think that from what I understand, that a standalone committee that works directly with the tribes is more beneficial, and if John Poupard would like to speak to that, I'd be happy to have him comment.
Mr. Poupard.
Yes. As chairman, members of the committee, the Indian Affairs Council, or the 11 tribes in Minnesota, are a part of this legislation. They're identified. They would have 11 seats selected by themselves, and the 10 other positions would be selected by the Dakota Ojibwe Language Revitalization Alliance. So they are involved in the construct of the council, and they would have, in my view, controlling interest if you count the numbers 11 to 10.
Representative Erickson.
A follow-up to you, Mr. Poupard. What is the language that the children of your tribes need to speak to get jobs?
Mr. Poupard?
More than likely it would be English. Ms. Charlie.
Thank you.
Are there any further questions? Representative Wardlaw.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How many different Native American languages are there in Minnesota, and are you trying to reinstate all of them, or just some of them, or?
Mr. Poupard.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, there are essentially two major tribes or groups of Indians in Minnesota. One of them is the Anishinaabe, or the Chippewa, and the other is the Dakota, or the Sioux, as they've been called. And this is where the focus lies in the language. Of course, there are numerous other tribes in Minnesota, particularly in the metropolitan area. But the Dakota Ojibwe Language Revitalization Alliance focused on these two major tribes. That is, and if the others show an interest, we certainly would develop some kind of an apparatus to attend to that interest.
I'm sorry for delaying. My wife called too. Where are you? And
well, you can blame me, Representative Wardlaw.
I did. That's why. Not really. I'm assuming that English would be spoken as well, or taught as well, at least in the second year, or something like that. Is that correct?
Mr.
Poupard, obviously English is the predominant language in our society, and so much so that our native languages have have been fading over time. So the immersion method is one way of concentrating and more quickly learning that language, learning the languages. And but still in the mainstream society, we would still be using the English language.
Representative Lai.
Yes. My hope was that in John Bupart's earlier statement, it would be clearer that it's not easy, I think, for us who grow up in Caucasian culture to really understand what has happened to Native culture and how important language is to them, and why I think this is such an important thing to follow through on. And added to that, I guess I would say the reason for the Independent Council, in addition to that, is that it gives greater focus to just this one issue and the sense of urgency around the fact that there are fewer and fewer speakers of the language left. But I think we need to understand that in order for Native Americans to achieve the kind of success that we can naturally access through our system, I think this is something that they need and something that we can help them provide. Certainly they will learn English and they will participate in our culture as they have for some time. But in order to succeed in a way that lets them reach the full level of their ability and achievement, I think this is a great measure to do that.
Thank you. Representative Gryling and Representative Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wondered if we could have a translation for the last sentence of the second testifier.
It's wonderful. I know part of that, but Ms. Bendixson.
Chairman Mariani and committee members, Pidama Yaya means thank you in Dakota, and Miigwech means thank you in Ojibwe.
Mm-hmm. Representative Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I won't take long. We do know that anthropologists have made it clear that language is more than simply a means of communication. It is the root of cultures. And considering the history of the Native American peoples in North America, it's the least we could do to allow Native Americans to have courses in their language. I know in Edina schools we have immersion classes in French, and I know a lot of school districts have them in other languages. No one seems concerned that our children are going to end up unable to get a job because they are now competent in French. Although I understand there is opposition to anything French in America recently. But that didn't stop Edina, and those children are doing just fine, thank you. So I don't see why, if the Anglo community can have immersion coursework, why Native Americans can't. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Swales.
Thank you, Chair Mariani. I just want to comment, and it's not a question to the testifiers, but more to just to make a statement. I just recently was teaching a literary analysis in my AP English class where we were applying various texts to a culture that was a Caribbean culture. We used one author who stated that the loss of one's tongue is the same as the loss of one's culture. And I think about many of my students. Some are from China, some are from Taiwan, some are from India, some are from Africa. And in each of their communities, they go to a school where they continue to learn Chinese, or they learn the particular tongue that they were speaking in India, or they are continuing to speak their East African languages. And yet, some of these students are the brightest and going off to Ivy League schools. I just want us to be cautious of not smacking of I don't know what I want to say, but we just need to be and embrace the cultures and the heritages of all people in our state.
Thank you. And members, I'm a little bit familiar with the Maori transformation. It really was quite dynamic, and perhaps the testifiers might want to further some literature sites for us to read up on what's happening with the Maori. I had a terrific visit with Net Life Superintendent not too long ago, where their turnaround in test scores, tests in English, have been driven in part, by a revitalization effort with the Ojibwe language. So thank you, Representative Bly, for bringing this bill for us today. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on this bill? We did have someone from the Board of Teaching, but I believe that their concerns have been met with in the delete all amendments, so thank you for working with the board in this regard. Members, if there's no further questions, then I will renew my motion that House File 779 as amended be recommended to pass and be referred to the Finance Committee. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign.
Aye.
Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Bly. Thank you, members.
If I could just make one, in the packet, there is an article about that cites some of the...
Oh, terrific. Thank you. I will look for that. Thank you. Representative Bly. Oh, no, I'm sorry, Representative Benson. Sorry, Representative Bradley. Oh, boy, I just lost probably a quarter million in the K-12 Finance Committee just now. I got it. Representative Benson, House File 234, would you care to move your bill?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move House File 234 and that be recommended for passage and sent on to K-12 Finance.
Thank you. Representative Benson moves House File 234 be recommended to pass and refer to Finance for further referral to K-12 Finance.
And I will have an oral amendment as well.
You have a delete all amendment, it looks like.
Yes.
Is that correct?
An oral amendment to my delete all.
Let's take your delete all first and then we'll fix up that delete all with your oral amendment. Bless you. Representative Benson moves the delete all amendment H0234.
Yep.
DE1.
Yep.
That is before us, and members, this delete also puts it almost into shape. We want the bill before us. So all in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. The bill is amended before us in the DE1, and you, and Representative Benson, you have a oral amendment.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. If you turn to page 5, to line 5.11, it reads Minnesota Statutes 206, sections 123B, 0.749, there should be a period there, and the rest of that line would be deleted, and we'd also delete 5.12. They're redundant, I understand.
Representative Benson, I believe counsel wants to give you counsel on that. Ms. Larson.
All right.
Madam Chair, members, on page 5, line 12, delete subdivision 2, comma, R, and insert is.
Oh, I see. And Representative Benson, is that... that you incorporate that into your motion?
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All right. Thank you. Members... Yes, let's read the amendment. Perhaps Ms. Larson could do that for us.
Madam Chair, members, on page 5, line 11, delete sections and insert section, and delete semicolon 124D.081, comma, subdivision 9, semicolon, and 124D.69, comma. And on page 5, line 12, delete subdivision 2, comma, R, and insert is.
Terrific. Does everyone have that before them? So, Representative Benson, you moved that oral amendment. Actually, you can incorporate that, I believe.
Yes,
so
okay. I will incorporate
that. Oh, no, we already... You're right. Mm-hmm. You're right. Mm-hmm. So we have to vote on it. This is going to be a close one. members, all in favor of the oral controversial amendment that Representative Benson has before us, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The amendment is amended. Representative Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Ms. Larson, I'm shocked to notice I missed that, having taught English for a number of years. And I remember the diagramming on the board that I did way back when I was teaching 7th grade English. And so thank you for catching that. Mr. Chairman and committee, there were many reasons I ran for office, but one of them, one principal reason, for seeking office was to try to return as much as possible decision-making to local government and local school boards. And I suspect one of the things that motivated me a number of years ago was watching a proposal during the old profiles in learning days when there was actually a discussion that teachers should send all their lesson plans over the State Board of Education for perusal, and then they would be returned to us. And I had a vision of 34,000 teachers sending in thousands and thousands and thousands of study, lesson plans to the State Board of Education. Now, that may have been only a wives' tale or an urban legend, but many of us, many people where I was teaching, believed it might actually happen, which would have ground education absolutely to a halt. So, except for oversight to make sure that districts are not discriminating against children based on race or ethnic background or gender or other issues like that, I am very anxious to do what I can as a representative to see to it that the state's job return to helping find necessary resources for districts and then getting out of their way so they can do their job. So I'm very pleased to be able to carry this bill today because I think it could begin a process to unravel some of the web of rules, regulations, and reporting requirements that have grown up through a larger and larger bureaucracy both at the state level and in our local districts. The objective, hopefully, then, is that we can return some of those resources to the classroom instruction where they belong. So, now, you and I, or I alone, could go through each of the sections, but, Mr. Chairman, if I may, I'll turn it over to my testifiers. It's been a long day, and I haven't had lunch yet.
Mr. Representative Benson, I was here late last night. I didn't have dinner, so
You won me there. Okay. I have a few years on you, so I need nutrition more.
That's
than
the
you.
Food. Okay. We should walk through the bill.
Okay. Yes.
Just so we know what's before us. And
I think Jen will do.
Wonderful. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Johnson. If you state your name for the record, walk us through the bill, and then give us your testimony.
My name is Janet Johnson. I'm Director of Finance for Intermediate School District 287. I'm also on the Board of Directors of the Minnesota Association of School Business Officials, MASBO, as immediate past president. MASBO's legislative platform contains a proposal on mandate reduction and simplification of education finance system that includes many provisions of this bill. House File 234 contains provisions that would amend current statutes as they apply to school district operations and procedures for calculating and maintaining certain reserve accounts, preparation and dissemination of certain reports, submitting data to the Minnesota Department of Education through electronic reporting systems, and conducting primary elections in school districts. As school district finances have required reductions in programs and services, including services in the district office, the requirements for calculating these reserves, preparation of these reports, and conducting primary elections are the responsibility of district office personnel. The staff is already burdened with additional tasks due to the reduction of office personnel, and this work also uses the financial resources and budgets to continue to feel the effects of operations and inflationary pressures. In regards to this section of the bill requesting the elimination of certain reserve requirements, this bill would eliminate certain reserve accounts for which no specific authority remains. Complex categorical funding formulas require school districts to maintain a number of designated reserve accounts that must be held separately and used only for specific purposes. Maintaining these reserves adds complexity to school accounting and sometimes causes confusion for members of the public. In many cases, maintenance of the reserves is valid and necessary, but many others have outlived their usefulness. This request is similar to what you heard earlier in the Department of Ed policy bill that there was testimony on previously. In regards to eliminating certain reports, as school business officials, NASBO encourages you as legislators to strive to eliminate reports that are of little value and recommend that the Minnesota Department of Education work to streamline reporting procedures whenever possible. Reporting requirements require staff time at the school district and at the Minnesota Department of Education to prepare reports and to review them. One report we're looking at or requesting a change in is the publication of financial information. School districts are now required to publish budget data for the prior and current years in local newspapers by November 30th each year. This seems to be an antiquated and redundant requirement. Districts are required to provide budget information at their truth and taxation hearings, and actual revenue and expenditure information is available on the report cards published by the Minnesota Department of Education. Most districts also publish budget and audited expense and revenue information on their websites when accurate information is available. This bill clarifies the district's requirement to notify the public of relevant budget information, including the option to publish this data, and eliminates the requirement to publish the data.
Mr. Chairman, I don't know if it would be appropriate this time, but I am aware there is an amendment pending concerning this particular subdivision one.
Representative Graham.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's Amendment A2, and it wasn't in my packet, but it was over there. I don't know if other members have it in their packet or not.
Members, let us know if you don't have it. We'll get a page to get it to you. So, Representative Gravely, would you care to move your amendment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll move Amendment A2.
Right, Representative Gravely moves H.O. 234A2. Representative Gravely.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a lot of senior citizens in my district, and they are the very ones who like to follow the how much the taxes are going up and so forth. And this would allow school districts to actually not put things in the newspaper. They could put it on the web and so forth. But I suspect that they would choose to put it on the web if they were given that option. This would say they could do any of the options above, but they also have to publish it in the newspaper. There may be a day when we don't need to do that, but it'll have to be after people like me have died.
That could be years.
Officer Grauman, that could be decades.
You never know.
Representative Benson.
I would like to have the committee vote on that. Because I'm carrying the bill, I would probably vote against, but it is, may we say, not a absolutely essential part of this elite amendment.
Ms. Johnson. Or you don't have to say anything. I just thought maybe you might.
Well, there is a cost related to the publication. And in school districts, we are looking for every penny we can find.
Okay. Representative Welty.
Thank you, Chairman Mariani. I would have to agree with Representative Greiling, just for the fact that I've talked to hundreds, thousands of people in my district, and I have always been surprised by the number of people who do not have access to a computer or the internet, and their only means of access is through printed media. I definitely agree with the intent to cut down on the cost, and I know we can do that by putting it on the web, but we still do not have the capabilities in some parts of this state, and I would say all parts of the state, for people to have access to internet just for financial needs.
Representative Erickson, I think maybe I saw your hand.
Well, I just wanted to, I think that this is a good amendment. Representative Greiling, are you dealing with structural balance at all?
Representative Greiling.
Mr. Chair, Representative Erickson, not that I know of.
No, I didn't think so either, and I was going to say, thank you, because I'm of your vintage and a little older, but I do too think that we need to make this mandatory so that those who do want to track what school districts are doing can do so. And that is our senior citizens, and since I'm one of those now, I think I like to track. And then I can go on the net.
And members, just for the record, Representative Welty, who does agree, is younger than even the young chair. And so this could be an intergenerational vote. Is there any further discussion? Anyone in the audience wish to discuss the amendment? If not, then we'll vote on the A2 amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. The bill is amended with the A2 amendment. Representative Benson, perhaps Mr. Krumkus, you wish to offer any testimony?
Ms. Johnson still had a few sections.
Oh, I'm sorry. Ms. Johnson, please.
In regards to additional reports that we would like to have considered, the following reports are of little value, and this bill proposes that they should be discontinued. One is the superintendent's report on projected expenditures and student passage rates, initially designed to provide information on the level of funding necessary to reach a high level of students passing the basic standards test. This report is based on subjective estimates made in each district with no consistency between districts. No apparent use is made of the reports, and there is no evidence that the reports are even read. And again, this is one that was part of the Minnesota Department of Education policy bill that you heard earlier. A second report is the Notice to Principals of General Education Revenue Generated by Principals Attending a School Site. The information contained in this report is burdensome to calculate, and there is no evidence that the information has been used for anyone for any purpose. The third report is the Structural Balance Report. This report is intended to provide information to the public about the impact of salary settlements on district budgets. The reports are time-consuming to produce, but are of little or no value. Each report is subjective and based on assumptions about inflation, retirements, and future funding by the state. Each school district makes its own set of assumptions, and reports are not comparable between districts. With the uncertainty of future funding formulas, school districts are not able to predict or control revenues into the future. Additionally, these reports are not tied to the long-range planning of a school district. In regards to data reporting system, the Department of Education collects data through five major electronic reporting systems. UFARS, Uniform Financial Accounting and Reporting System, which collects revenue and expenditure data. EDRS, which is the Education Data Reporting System, which collects salary and pupil projection data. STARS, the STAR Automated Reporting System, which collects data on licensed and unlicensed staff. MARS, the Minnesota Automated Reporting Student System, which collects enrollment and demographic data, and EMAP, the Electronic Minnesota Accountability Plan, which collects data for the No Child Left Behind consolidated application processes. It's hard to get all your R's in alignment sometimes. There is overlap among these systems, particularly between UFARS, EDRS, STARS, and EMAP. As an example, district staff is required to report expenditure data for No Child Left Behind in the EMAP system, that is, budget estimates by employee name. In the EDRS system, districts provide budget estimates, actual expenditures, and licensure information by employee name. In the UFARS system, we provide actual expenses. And in the STARS system, we provide licensure and assignment data. Both EDRS and EMAP require a massive data entry and verification effort. The Data is pulled from the district's operating systems. That is the financial accounting, the human resources, and student accounting systems. Those systems process the detail that provide all the state-mandated UFARS, STARS, and MARS reporting. This bill would require the Department of Education to analyze the department's data collection procedures and to analyze any standalone school district reporting requirements and recommend elimination of any district reports that are duplicative or have other data already collected by the department. In addition, the report would contain a recommendation for a streamlined, web-based system of reporting school district data. The department would be required to provide a report on these items to the education committees of the legislature by January 15, 2008. With that, I thank you for the opportunity to appear before the committee.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Johnson. Representative Wardlaw, I believe you had a question, and I was asleep at the wheel when you were trying to get my attention.
Now's a good time. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Explain the part again to me about salary projections and structural balance not necessary. That really throws a red flag in my direction, I'll tell you.
Ms. Johnson.
The structural balance report is one that is required as we reach conclusion of negotiation processes with the various bargaining units. And it is intended to provide information about the ultimate impact on the district's budget of the salary settlement. It's very time-consuming and difficult to pull the numbers together in the format requested for this report. Much of this information has been provided and shared in the course of working through negotiations. You have to make some assumptions about inflation, about future funding, and each school district handles that differently as they prepare this report. And we really feel that it is it doesn't provide meaningful information that is helpful.
Mr. Chairman, may I add a couple of points? The arguments for it is that this is providing more clear reporting to the public, and there's some merit to that, and to make sure that districts do not spend more than they have. I think it's redundant, first of all, because state law already requires a balanced budget for school districts. Why we need to send a report to the Commissioner of Education and have the Commissioner of Education send a report somewhere back, when all we would have to do, if people would like some reporting like this, is to introduce a bill simply stating that the local school district should put in clear writing in the print media or electronic media and both exactly what they have done in negotiations. I think that's a reasonable solution. My objective in trying to get rid of this particular section, Section 8, is to eliminate one more report. And we do have maybe a copy, which if someone who may be speaking in opposition to my position here might be willing to show you. It's four pages in great detail, and at the end of it, there's a section for written commentary. Now, why we need to send this off to the state bureaucracy to deal with an issue of simple communication with the voters, I don't quite comprehend, because all it does is lead to more bureaucracy, another report to the commissioner of several pages, and districts are already, by the way, failing to fill these out. In fact, one copy I saw only showed one page completed, and it was sent in. And I think testimony could reveal the fact that many of these districts simply are not even complying with the law presently. And I think a good indication of whether a law is useful or not is when we see a massive rejection of complying with it. It's just another one of these efforts to try to keep track of local government and local school districts from the state level. And one of the things I heard when I was running for office was from some legislators that there's always a great talk about turning power back over to local government and school districts, but they never do it. It's all talk, no action. And I really think it's time for some action, at least in some of these small areas like this. So this material, in my opinion, could be put on websites or in the local school districts. And after all, we elect school board members, and I think it's time we let school board members, again, have some say in how they run their local schools. Because if they're doing it wrong, then the voters can put someone else in.
Representative Wardlaw.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My thought is that the public, that's good information the public might want to know. Not everybody, but there are some that would like to know that. And I don't care if the Department of Education knows it. What I care about is the local folks.
But we have this large representative, Mr. Chair.
I'm sorry, Representative Benson.
Representative Wardle, I'm trying to do it properly here. I agree with you, and I think there's a much simpler way to communicate this to the voters. Why we have to fill out four pages, send it to the commissioner's office, hire a bureaucrat to disseminate this out again to the local districts, I just don't understand what the usefulness of that is. It's not very good utility of resources. If you want to require the local districts to make sure they put it in clear, understandable English to the voters in their districts, that would be a fine amendment. But to this system that we presently have is cumbersome and bureaucratic. It's the Bureaucrats Full Employment Act.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Benson, do you realize you're repealing the entire law, though? The structural balance law, not just a report?
Sounds like a good idea.
Representative Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Erickson.
Well, I was part of one of the creators of this, and...
I'm sorry, I stepped on your toe there.
that doesn't bother me one bit. We're busy adding more bureaucracy every day in this committee, so the fact that there's more bureaucracy is not part of the argument. This was designed for accountability, though, for a process for school boards to use, because what we determined as we watched salaries increase and budgets, the state dollars going to school districts disappear, we determined that school boards needed a more definitive process by which to okay their collective bargaining units so that they weren't imbalanced. And I don't care if there's any report either, but I think the process itself has told school boards that we're paying attention to the fact that they not overspend what is appropriated each biennium. And for that reason, you know, I oppose Section 8 repealer of 123B.749. We can probably take out parts of it, but to do away with a process that holds the school board accountable to its school district residents and also to the legislature, I think is not only wrong, but it's irresponsible.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Erickson, state law requires a balanced budget. And the fact that some school districts chose to overspend and find themselves maybe in statutory deficit is a problem I think the parents and the taxpayers of that district ought to deal with. The farther we move school decision-making from parents and from the school boards that they elect, the less people have a sense of ownership in the schools. And since we have on the books a law that clearly states that schools have to have balanced budgets, I find your proposal, in due respect, redundant, because I think there are mechanisms for dealing with this. And for example, if a school district did raise salaries too much, Well, then they're going to have to make a choice, aren't they? They may have to increase class size, or they may have to reduce some programs that the local community would want. And if they do that, then they are going to face the voters. And if they are doing something the voters think is improper, then I hope that the voters will replace those people and put someone else on the school board that more carefully mirrors the desires of that local district. Again, I just think the state should keep its nose on local school business to the greatest degree possible. Let's see the state government for the first time in several years adequately funded our schools. That's our responsibility. And the rest of it, keep your nose out of what's going on in local districts. That's up to the parents, the administrators that they hire, and the school boards that govern it. And I think they're perfectly competent to do it, way more than the state government, frankly.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Harris.
Just one final comment. I hope we'll have someone in the audience who will help explain, you know, all the new members on this committee, why this is an important process, and you know, the fact that we require school boards to balance their budgets is in law, indeed. But I don't know what's done about it.
We do have two individuals who have asked to testify: Stacia Smith with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, and Jim Bartholomew with the Minnesota Business Partnership. And I believe they want to testify on this point particularly. So why don't you come down and identify yourself for the record and give us your testimony. Welcome, Mr. Bartholomew. Please identify yourself for the record and give us your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Jim Bartholomew with the Minnesota Business Partnership, and I'm going to try to reflect Ms. Stacia Smith's comments with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. Unfortunately, she must have got a firmer call than Representative Wardlow did, and I'll be getting one soon as well. The description so far, it has been accurate, and I do want to start out by saying we completely support the goal of what Representative Benson is doing in terms of trying to repeal unnecessary mandates on local school districts and unneeded reports to the state. I guess in that process, every once in a while, there's a rub of what's an unneeded or unnecessary report or process. But we very much support the direction that he's going and want to support that. And I also want to mention that I very much appreciate the time he spent talking about this with us and trying to find some middle ground, and we would like to continue that as well. And I'll just be real quick. The structural balance report, as Representative Erickson had mentioned, was really a public information tool in terms of for the public to know, have a better insight of what's going on in the school district spending decisions. It is correct. In the department's website under the report cards or in our district budgets that we get in the newspaper occasionally, we get summative data of what the revenues and expenditures are. But we don't, as the public, really get a way to identify how those bottom lines actually were arrived at. And that's what I handed out. Is just the first page of one of the reports. I'll show the other one.
Please show all four.
Here's what they look like, members. It's just, you have the first page. Here's a district. Here's a district that filed their report, filled in the top, and then left everything else blank. So there's not a lot of help to the public to try and figure out what's going on. But all it asks, there are two parts of it. One is the individual summary for that particular contract, and then it's basically repeated with the district summary. And all it is asking for is the revenues and expenditures of the various funds, the general fund, food service fund, community service fund. So it just tries to get the big picture numbers out there. And what I've handed out is an example. On the bottom half for the individual summary, the top line is the revenues, for the 3 years that are required, 2 years for the contract, and then the 1 year after. Then the settlement and all other costs are basically the expenditures, and I added those up at the bottom. And then there's a line for the fund balance. As you can see, it goes from $8 million to minus $4 million, essentially. And we understand that there are frustrations from the district level with compiling these reports. And I think that what we've tried to do the last couple of years is come up with some ways to fix it so it's more effective for the districts to use it, so it can be better, an informational tool for the public. And some of those fixes have been in legislation introduced both here and in the other body. Some of them, you know, are very simple. One is clarify that districts can't use one-time money for ongoing expenses, which is what happened in this case. I suspect there are a number of things are happening here. But clearly the fund balance was in the black by over $8 million, and by the end of the period here, it's in the red by $3.9 million. So as someone from the public, I'm going to guess that they were using some one-time money to pay for ongoing costs, and things have begun to catch up with them. Another thing that we think would be a helpful fix is to specify, and this isn't saying you can't spend more than you've got, and all it's saying is if you're in the situation that this district is, provide in the narrative, which for this district was left blank, some explanation of how you're going to accommodate the deficit. And my district was in a similar situation to this, and they just left the number and they had no narrative for how they were going to resolve that. And that's fine. But then if someone in the public, like I said, not to be long because we're all going to get phone calls soon, but there is summative data out there. This is one of those tools, as imperfect as it may be, that gives the public an idea of how we got to those bottom line numbers, that total revenue, total expenditures. This is gives us an idea of how it all arrived. And again, I just want to close by saying we're hoping to continue to work with Representative Benson and you to find a way that makes this work better. We think it's worth saving, and thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Bartholomew. Any questions? Representative Welty, I think you had a question earlier.
Well, I believe my question was related to the website. I mean, we're talking about this information being made available. How many, do we have any idea of how many people actually know that this information is up on a website and actually go to it and find out what their district is doing?
Mr. Bartholomew.
Representative Welty, I don't know how many, you know, I don't know if the department tracks the hits to it or what advertising is done either by the department or the individual school districts to let parents know that that data is there. I may be a bit of an anomaly, but as I mentioned earlier, our district went through, as an individual, not for the partnership, our district went through some financial difficulties, and I was able to find the website. And unfortunately, when I got to my district, it was a bit of a mixed bag in the sense I got some numbers but no explanation of how to accommodate the deficit. And I just, as an aside, when I went through all 430-some districts last summer, there were about a third of them, since 2001, have only filed one report or no reports. So if I was a parent in one of those districts that didn't bother to file, that's an example of something we can make it better and more useful. I don't think because districts haven't reported it and then nobody has anything to look at, we should repeal it.
Representative Welty.
Well, in a way, I think you make a good point that if there are a lot of school districts that aren't even reporting and no one's really paying attention and calling them on it, that maybe people are not seeking this information out. And Secondly, I just want to, maybe the department can answer this, or Representative Benson can answer this, but the schools have to report information, and I believe that schools that are in statutory operating debt then have assistance from the Department of Education. They come and assist those schools to try to get them out of statutory operating debt. And I know this because one of my local school districts was in statutory operating debt. Does your language, does your bill prevent the Department of Education from obtaining that information?
In no way.
Representative Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. No, Representative Welty. No, it does not.
And to follow up that, Chairman Mariani and Representative Benson, so can you guarantee me that in your bill, with the language that you have in here and the information, well, the changes that you're making, that we're not going to take away from any of the information that's current, that the Department of Education needs?
They're all, Mr. Chairman, Representative Welty, as we heard in testimony earlier, the Department of Education receives many, many reports. We just listed, or our presented just listed five different things, for example, and even among those five, many of them are redundant. I don't want to get into the debate, but this is a very nice young, very nice gentleman here that he and I have discussed this at length. But frankly, I think he made my case for me. We've got districts that are not filling out the forms. We have no indication of who is even asking for this information or whether anyone is at all. Again, I don't want to come across here as some kind of a Luddite, or some kind of a negative fellow, but I just think that every opportunity we have to reduce the paperwork and reporting and bureaucracy, either at the state level or the local government or school district level, is a good thing. And if someone is worried that people in the community are not aware of what their local school board is doing, number one, I tell them, get off the couch and find out. And secondly, if that's not sufficient, well, let's require the local districts to put something in the local media. Doesn't the media ever show up at school board meetings anymore? Do they never report? I know they do in the Sun Sailor out in Minnetonka and the Lakeshore News in Wayzata and in Hopkins. We've got a situation here in which we just have layer after layer after layer of bureaucracy. I sound like, I don't know, former Senator Goldwater or somebody here, I guess. I don't know, but it's really time that we actually do something and not just keep adding more and more and more and more.
Members, it is Friday. It's almost 6. We have two other bills, but we'll stay here as long as you all want. Representative Lane and then Representative Harrison.
Could I represent?
Very briefly, Mr. Bartholomew.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Welty. In some of the comments, districts may not like the report, but it's a state law. And I, like I said, we totally support where you're going with the bill as a whole. But if districts can selectively choose which laws to follow, I think there's a deeper conversation rather than just.
Thank you, Representative Lane.
Mr. Chairman, just a moment.
Representative Benson.
Yeah.
Please.
The issue of enforcement of law is not what we're discussing here. That's a separate issue. You deal with the Attorney General on that. What I'm talking about is removing redundant regulations, rules that are not serving any useful public purpose.
Very well. Representative Lane.
Mr. Chair, actually what we're about is setting reasonable laws. That's the job. And this whole thing is about school boards annually notifying the public of all this information. So that's a given. Now, looking at this example that you gave us, it's very disturbing to me in what it truly says. You're saying that here's an example of somebody who didn't live within their budget. What it says to me is schools are in dire need. What they had was a decrease in revenue, and schools don't
make money. They receive it. And what they have here in their settlement of benefits and salary was 3.8, according to my calculations, 3.8% over 2 years. I imagine that was in their health benefits. I imagine they didn't get any raise. And what they spent in costs with a mere pittance again, I imagine it's actually less than inflation, and I imagine it went to heat and other things like that. They did major cutbacks to get to this level. And what it says to me is our schools are crying out for need for money, and what we have to do is cut back on the bureaucracy and give that money to the schools.
Thank you, Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I agree. I want to cut back on the bureaucracy, too. And I'll remind all of you of that in K-12 when I see all that bureaucracy coming up in so many bills. But, you know, Representative Benson, I'm going to have an oral amendment here, but I'm hoping that, you know, if you are truly concerned about how this statute reads, that we can work together and make it something that's going to work for school districts. But this is a process that's important, and this is accountability to the public. And this is probably in need of revision by now, but to get rid of the whole thing, I just think is wrong at this point, when we have not even had a full-blown debate on this particular issue. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'd like to move an oral amendment to delete Section 8 and ask for a roll call.
Representative Erickson moves to delete Section 8 from the delete all amendment, and she requests a roll call vote. Discussion. Members, our very first roll call. It's wonderful. Representative Lane.
I would just say I'm voting no.
With no further discussion, we'll proceed with the roll call.
Representative Miami.
No.
Representative Abler is absent. Representative Benson.
No.
Representative Brown.
No.
Representative Dabney is absent. Representative Demmer is absent. Representative Detmer is absent. Representative Erickson.
Yes.
Representative Batwald is absent. Representative Reiling.
No.
Representative Hyerson is absent. Representative Florenstein is absent. Representative Hosh.
No.
Representative Lane.
No.
Representative Norris is absent. Representative Peterson.
No.
Representative Slawick is absent. Representative Slocum is absent. Representative Wells. No. Representative Tilbury.
No.
Representative Erdo is absent. Representative Ward.
No.
Representative Wardlow.
Yes.
Representative Welty.
No.
And Representative Dietrich, I apologize for skipping you. And stepped out. All right.
Is there anyone who did not vote? Yeah. The motion had two yeses and 11 noes, and the motion does not prevail. Representative Hosh, and then I think we're ready to move on. Folks,
thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm going to try to make this quick. I don't talk often, but this is real important to me. I was originally going to offer an amendment, but due to the lack of the chance to talk to the author of the bill, I'm not going to offer an amendment at this time, but I want to let the committee know about Sections 5 and 6 in this bill that would eliminate the requirement for a primary election for the school board. This law came out from the experience that we had at the St. Cloud School District. I believe we had 12 people running for three positions. The top vote getter got 19%, and our school district, in my opinion, and I think the public's opinion, was in poor shape management-wise by that school board. I adamantly oppose changing this law. And I appreciate when Representative Benson said we should face the voters. I absolutely think so. But when there's a problem is obviously present if 12 people are running for two positions or three positions. And we need to face voters with accountability in which voters can make a decision among a good slate of candidates without an overabundance of candidates. And also, I think it's important, you spoke of local ownership also. There's local ownership and there's board ownership. And I don't want to have a school board dictating if there's going to be a primary or not. They have their own fate in their hands at that point. I'm very concerned about this. I hope this is removed, or I hope this can be addressed. The St. Cloud School Board now is in great hands. There's been significant changes. We passed two levies, but before, we were in dire straits. And we saw that. Voters woke up and stood up and wanted to do something about it. The problem is too many people wanted to do something about it. And when the election came and when we went to go face the voters, the top vote getter only got 19%. So I hope we can work on this, Representative Benson. But there's a very good reason why this came forward, and I think it stands reason that we continue to do this. As state representatives, we have to face a primary along with most people. So I hope this can be addressed in future committees.
Representative Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Representative Hosh. We just talked about it here briefly, and I do appreciate your giving us some time to discuss it. And that was very nice of you to do that. I just would say in response that traditionally school districts have had this right, as, by the way, they had a right for at least 150 years to communicate with their local citizens about what they were doing with the budget. But that's, we've already discussed that issue before. I am aware of that problem that you described. There was also one, I believe, in St. Cloud, Minnesota. That was the one you were discussing. But I also might mention, we're getting late here, so I don't want to spend very much time, but Robbinsdale, for example, had three openings and seven candidates. And so under the law as it's presently written, Robbinsdale had to hold a primary election. And shortly before the primary, one of those candidates dropped out. Under the laws as presently written, Robbinsdale would not have had to spend the $40,000 they had to spend to run that primary election. But it was already too late. The car was out of the garage, so to speak, and they were already running down the road, and the money had already been spent, and the election had been set up. And so Robbinsdale school district had to take $40,000 out of its funding to run this election. And from what I have heard, about 1% of the voters turned out. Again, Mr. Chairman and committee members, let's really think carefully about what we can do to return these decisions to the elected officials in our local school districts and communities. Are they going to make mistakes? Yes, that's what we call democracy. Lots of times in democracies, mistakes are made. And we certainly don't want a situation like they had in Iraq when they decided to set up that first National Assembly and had something like 8,000 candidates running and several hundred for president. No wonder they had and still have a problem in Iraq, but we haven't reached that point yet. But you do have a situation here that was a legitimate problem, and I can understand why that would allow maybe some wingnut to get onto the school board, you know, because of the low turnout. That's true, and I understand that. But there is a downside too, in again mandating to local school districts how they're to spend their money and how they're to run their elections. So.
Representative Dutcher.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Benson, I just wanted to point out that if this is becoming a controversial part of your bill, that this might not need to go forward in the bill that contains some other provisions I know you feel strongly about. I am carrying an elections bill, and we've had it heard in government ops, and it does exactly that. And we're more than happy to work with you, Representative Hosh, and talk to you a little bit more about that and how we can work together on that. So just so you know, that is also traveling through another route, and if it messes up what you're trying to do here, maybe you just want to abandon that thought.
Thank you, Representative. And if we're successful, this will go on to the next committee, and we can have plenty of time to work this out to your satisfaction and mine.
Representative Erickson?
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to know if the Minnesota School Board Association had an opinion on this. Perhaps they do not.
We'll find out.
Mr. Deans is here. Good idea.
Good evening, sir. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, my name is Tom Deans. I'm legal counsel of the School Board Association. Those two election provisions are provisions that are basically sponsored by the School Board Association in Representative Dietrich's bill. This would allow school districts to be treated the same way that cities are treated, and would, in those school districts that know, you know, every year you've got lots of people that are going to file, this would allow them to opt into having the primary. In the other ones where they're struggling to find three people to run, they probably would not.
Thank you.
Thank you. I see no further questions. Is there anyone else in the audience? Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Wardlaw.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My wife says hurry up. Representative Benson, Mr. Bartholomew was kind of talking for me, it seemed like, because I agree you're going in the right direction. You sound an awful lot like a Republican sometimes.
I'm not going to admit it here, Representative Wardlow, but I have voted. I've gone on the other side, on the dark side, a couple of times.
Well, I'm not going to tell you who endorsed me, but I've been blamed for that, too. No, I forgot what I was going to say. Oh. I'm just hoping that you'll, I voted with Representative Erickson about deleting Section 8 because on one, throwing it away means maybe we should bring some of it back, and keeping it in means maybe we should take some of it and throw it away. But I hope you work with Mr. Bartholomew and others in that direction. Thank you.
Thank you. Members, if we stay here later, we'll turn off the lights and we'll all be on the dark side. I believe we've had a good vetting of your bill, Representative Benson, and so Representative Benson renews his motion that House File 234 as amended be recommended to pass and referred to Finance Committee, and we're issuing a recommendation that it be referred to the K-12 Finance Committee. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Garland. Representative Garland, I apologize to your testifier, who I'm sure was here for quite a while. I appreciate her patience. Mr. Garland, would you care to move your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will move House File 236, and then I do have a delete all amendment.
Representative Growley moves House File 236 be recommended to pass, and I assume referred to the Finance Committee, and that will be headed toward your committee, and with a recommendation to go to the K-12 Finance Committee. Representative Growley then moves HL236DE1, and this is the delete all amendment, so this will put the bill in the shape that you want us to look at today. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Representative Granley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. We passed a good law recently that has the Department of Education taking over the paperwork for special ed billing. However, we need more time for districts and intermediate school districts and special education cooperatives to be able to accomplish this transition. So the delete all amendment, the original bill, the department had some problems with the way it was worded, but I think the intent was mutual in this delete all amendment. The interested parties worked it out with Dr. Melcher, who's also sitting here waiting for this little bill. So with that, I do have with me Christine Carr, the business manager from the Intermediate School District 916, who could add a sentence or two, and then we'll both stand for questions. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Wonderful. Welcome, Ms. Carr. Again, thank you for your patience this evening. Please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair and committee members, I'm Christine Carr, Director of Administrative Services for Intermediate School District 916. And I will be very brief. I just wanted to make the committee aware that there are three basic areas where we feel there's a cause for asking for this delay. One is in the fact that the methodology designed by the department to take over the tuition billing has required major changes to the major reporting systems of the state, the EDRS, the UFARS, and the MARS that you heard about just briefly in the last testimony. All of those require major changes in order to implement the system correctly, and many school districts have not had the time or the training to implement these changes, and therefore the rates that are being charged currently are not accurate rates. The training for the new system began in June of 2006, and in the EDRS it began in October of 2006. So as a practical matter, there has not been time to implement this system correctly. The second issue that causes concern is in the area of budgets. Districts are now receiving bills that are showing major and unexpected shifts in rates. So most of that is probably because of the timing and the training. When they did their budgets for June of 2006, they had not yet had training in the new billing system. So they're getting some surprises in their tuition bills. That is another reason why we would put this forward. Sometimes the rates are being much more averaged and not reflective of the services that the special education students are receiving. They will have had no changes in the sites or the services that the students have received from year to year, yet there are major swings in the rates that they're seeing come through. And finally, to that end, the predictability that's needed in budgets for every school, you want to know what you're going to spend for the next year, is being compromised with this system currently. As a side issue for intermediates only, I don't know that this issue is true so much for K-12s, but another reason that the intermediates or cooperatives would ask for this kind of a delay is because we do not have a cash flow mechanism for our school other than to receive the tuition rates. And under the new system, we would be required to enter into the 10% holdback system, which would, for the three intermediates in the metropolitan area, amount to about a $6 million holdback that we have no methodology to cash flow. And so we would ask for the delay in order to work on some change in the system so that we can accommodate that. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Carr. Are there any questions? Is there anyone in the audience that wishes to testify on this bill? Representative Greiley.
Mr. Chair, I hope everyone will support this amendment. My husband's calling me, too.
Oh, boy. I'm going to be in deep trouble with lots of spouses tonight, folks. Very well. Representative Greiley renews her motion that House File 236 as amended be recommended to pass and refers to the Finance Committee with a further recommendation that it be re-referred to K-12 Finance. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Finally, members, thank you all for your patience. House File 1425, Representative Hoberg. Representative Hoberg, the chair moves that House File 1425 be recommended to pass and referred to, this is going to the floor, to the General Register.
And Mr. Chair, that's what your committee administrator said, and the Senate will take this bill up on the Senate floor on Monday. And given the lateness of the hour, I'm not sure that it will make committee report for Monday. And so I don't know if it's the committee's will to put on the consent calendar that would save the step of the Rules Committee and getting to the calendar for the day. But there is a DE1 amendment to the bill in the shape, so it would be the exact wording of the Senate file.
Mr. Chair, I'll move the bill if you'd like.
Representative Erickson, I had already moved the bill.
Mr. Chair, I'll move the delete all.
Representative Erickson will move H-1425 DE1 amendment.
Yes.
All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. The bill is now before us in the DE1 amendment. Representative Holbert.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't have any testifiers here today. You allowed me 10 minutes, and the principal from Sober High in Burnsville was going to come but had a really horrendous number of circumstances in her school today, as some of you in this room could probably relate to, given that many of you are educators or former educators. So, and I had Hazleton representatives in the Senate hearing, but because of the brevity issue, I told them not to come today. So I'm without witnesses, but hopefully can tell the story. First of all, what this bill does not do This bill does not change any standards related to a student athlete's behavior and state high school league rules. If a student is caught in violation of use of chemicals, alcohol, behavior, or rules in a particular district, a student would have to follow those rules and pay the penalties just like any other student athlete. The other thing that this doesn't relate to directly is any of the controversy relative to open enrollment and transfers, and I'll get to that in a little bit later. The situation right now is for students that go through a treatment program, and as a part of their aftercare is suggested that they attend a sober school or a special school that provides service for emotional behavioral health, they are literally at the whims, if you will, of districts on whether or not they can play sports. In order for them to have access to state high school league sports, if the school they are attending does not have a program, they have to find a district that will enter into a cooperative agreement. And we have, in the testimony from the school administrators, virtually no districts do this. It's on a case-by-case basis. Many school districts, in fact, have policies that prohibit cooperative agreements, and in the case of a student, the situation that was highly publicized last fall, in Lakeville South student, she was allowed to practice with the team but not become part of the team, and she was a very accomplished swimmer. She was being courted by college recruiters, and what happened is she practiced with the Lakeville swim team, and when it got to postseason play, Lakeville team went to Rochester for the sections in AA. She went to Invergrove Heights as an individual, sober high, one-person team, and swam there. She was not allowed to swim in any relays, and in fact could only compete at the single A level, and her parents were very angry about that, what they viewed as a second class. opportunity. So what this bill would do is it would basically treat these kids like homeschool students. In 2003, the legislature passed legislation that required all homeschool students to have access to athletics in the district in which they reside. This bill is very narrow in scope. They can't play anywhere. They can only play in their resident district. And it would really stop a lot of rigmarole. My daughter got out of treatment in the end of January, has always played sports, and, sorry.
It's quite all right, Representative Holbrook.
Wanted to again, and Burnsville High School, or Burnsville Schools, turned down Burnsville Sober High, and so we started working with Lakeville. And it was a lot of work. I had to be very tenacious, and imagine that. initially they weren't agreeable at all, and I kept pushing the issue, and I made dozens of phone calls and read pages and pages of information on the web. And I guess the thing is that, I mean, my daughter can play. She can play this spring. But I then started talking to some of her new peers, and they don't have a chance. There was a young man by the name of Grant that wants to play tennis this season. The season starts next week. He happens to reside in a school district that has a straight-up policy, no cooperative agreement. Grant will not play tennis in a sport, in a high school athletic program without this bill. So that's part of the reason why there's a need to expedite this. And I think it's very narrowly drafted. There were some concerns by the school board association. They don't want this opened up to all charter schools. And so the language on line 1.9, to limit it to recovery-focused high schools, that would relate to the alcohol, substance abuse, mental illness, or emotional disturbance part of it.
And then they also added language that result on lines 1.14 and 5. We originally had a student violating a league rule. They added or district rule because some school districts have additional athletic standards beyond what the state high school league is. That comfort language satisfied the concerns of the school board association. In the case of my daughter, what will now have to happen if this bill doesn't move forward is she is now eligible to play, but she has she's not eligible to play on a varsity level for half of the season because she had a transfer. So now I'm starting to pursue the paperwork and the process with the state high school league to allow her to have varsity eligibility, which is a whole other rigmarole. And I don't know if she's going to make varsity, you know, but the thing is that if I don't pursue this, and if she does, then she'd have to sit on the bench for the half the season. And families that have gone through this don't need to have to deal with this.
Thank you, Representative Hulbert. We have a question for Representative Swales.
Not so much a question, Representative Holberg, but I'd like to just say that you are a champion. And, you know, more kids should have champions like you as their parents. And fortunately, by you trying to get this bill passed, you are going to allow an awful lot of young people to have a second chance. I have seen as a teacher so many kids stigmatized and labeled. And, you know, our culture has become that. It is so easy to stigmatize other people and then not to forgive them because they had a problem in their life. What you're doing is commendable. You have my full support. And this article that I've read about what you've experienced really touched me. And I just want to congratulate you on being such a tremendous champion for your daughter.
Thank you. Representative Tober.
I also would like to echo that. But also the courage that it takes to go into treatment and to do the things that are necessary to recover. We shouldn't stand in the way of life.
Well, and these kids, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, these kids are amazing. And what they're facing, I mean, a lot of adults don't have the courage to do what they do at such a young age. And they literally have to change their lives. They have to look for new healthy activities, new people to associate with. And the brightness and the courage these kids have is just really inspiring.
Representative Hodge.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Holberg, this is a great bill. When I was in high school at Totino Grace High School and playing football, we often bragged about how the team got a higher GPA than the school did. Than the rest of the school did. And we also bragged about how we didn't get into as much trouble. And it's that team environment that I think is essential towards recovery also. Being a bartender at St. John's University, I can tell you that the individuals involved in extracurriculars and our sporting activities didn't have to face the same pressures as some others did. And it's that team environment that that cohesiveness that's so important, and to have this bill be able to allow somebody to maintain that or enter into an environment in which they have mutual supports is so important. It's not just, you know, being a great advocate for your child, but also having that environment for somebody recovering. So this is a great bill. Thank you for bringing it.
Representative Ward.
Representative Goldberg, I want to thank you on behalf of all those kids out there that need you to be their champion. And I want to encourage you to approach the coaches, because I'm a former coach, 25-plus year coach, and I don't know, I know very few coaches that would say, no, we don't want to include, and we don't want to have participate, and we don't want those kids as a team member of ours. So I'm going to encourage, I don't care what this law does and when it starts, tomorrow I'll talk to those coaches. I'm just going to encourage you to do that. Well, thank you.
And Mr. Chair and Representative Ward, I heard more than one story, in fact, of coaches saying, yeah, come on back, and the kids would come back and start practicing, and then somebody from up above would trickle down, oh, you can't play with us. You haven't met the hoops. It's past the beginning of the season. It's too late for a cooperative agreement. you know, go back home, and it was hard on coaches, too, because they knew what was right. And I do have to say that my daughter did give me permission to do this, and I didn't just go out and do it, and so she has a lot of courage to imagine that.
Representative Wardlaw.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Certain athletic director from 196 emailed me yesterday and said, I believe it was this bill, said vote against it. And it seems to me, from what Representative Tilbury said, they've gone through a lot just to go through the treatment program. And it makes sense to me that being allowed to go back to their team is just a continuation of therapy, and that will help keep them on the right track. So I'm going to vote for this and then email him back and tell him I voted for it.
And Representative Wardlow, you need to know a number of the students that I talked to, given the location of the Burnsville High, are students of 196 that have been completely shut out.
Representative Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Very quick. Representative Holberg, I too support the bill. I would urge you, as it moves on, maybe to expand it. I don't understand why it should be applied only to schools that are working with kids who have chemical dependency already. The rest of the schools, I did a lot of coaching too. I would never turn away a kid. I know that. So that's one point. And this isn't meant to be light, because this is a serious subject, but that is in Wardlow. We have another example of bureaucrats again telling people what to do. So just want to mention that.
Is there anyone for Representative Grayley?
Mr. Chair, I didn't catch. What was the, do we have the consent agenda?
Representative Grayley, the motion is to refer to a floor to put on a general registry.
I would ask for the consent agenda.
Representative Growling, it is the mover, the maker's intent, desire that this go to the general registry. I am assured, did I say that right? The mover? The maker of the motion? That's my intent. And Representative Hubbard, I do understand the sense of urgency here. We have reassurances from the Speaker's Corner that they will move this along. It is our desire to have things move along on the floor of the House this year. So,
Mr. Chair, if I might, do you know if the committee report will be to the floor on Monday, or will we wait till Thursday for a committee report?
Is there a four-hour rule?
Well,
there's a four-hour rule. Is that, it sounds like it may be difficult to do by Monday. That's what I'm the sense I'm getting.
And Mr. Chair, I know you know that you. I'm just afraid that if we go to the general register and don't get there till Thursday, we're going to waste a whole week here.
Representative Holbert, what we've been told is that there will be extra sessions scheduled next week. So there's a good likelihood we won't need to wait till Thursday to make that happen. And Representative Holbrook, I do support your bill, and so I will certainly advocate to make sure that we get that heard.
And Mr. Chair, I appreciate the help that you've given me thus far on it as well.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know that you'll do your best to move this along, so thank you very much.
Thank you. Is there anyone else in the audience that wishes to testify on the bill? If not, members, I will renew my motion that House File 1425, as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to the General Registry. All in favor of that motion, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails.
Thank you,
Representative Holbrook. Members, thank you for your patience and your terrific vetting. Good debate, good patience. Thank you for our pages for hanging around and our staff for putting up with us. You're terrific. I hope you all have a terrific weekend. We'll see you next week. Should be a busy week next week. This meeting is adjourned.